Okay. Alrighty. So, welcome to, I guess this is the fifth lecture. We'll start, of course, as we always do, by going over the homeworks. I got a lot more emails on this one than I expected. I'll be honest, I think I must have answered about 20 questions on each day over the weekend, which is fine, okay? If something's not clear, please send mail. I don't want folks, you know, banging their heads against the wall because something's not clear. Question?
It would be nice to just mention, we all won't think you're stupid if you post your question to the mailing list, and it helps a lot of us who are pondering the same issues that you are. So I noticed some questions got sent directly to you, and I was just going to say.
A lot got sent directly to me. Whenever I basically noticed an issue that was common, I'd always ask somebody, if you ask me privately something, I'm not going to turn around and post your message back to the list. I'll ask you before I do that. And pretty much everyone I asked said, no, go ahead and forward it. But yeah, feel free to post stuff to the list too. That's part of why it's there. And you're also, you can do it either way. Okay, you can ask other students to help you out. I tend to be online a lot. I don't guarantee that I'm online all the time, so I can't guarantee, a service level of, an hour turnaround or something like that. But I think I was pretty good over the weekend, all things considered. So, let's go on, start. So the point of the questions from this homework were to try and get you more into an engineering feel for how we deal with security protocols and some of the trade-offs that we face when we're taking these core cryptographic primitives and trying to turn them into protocols that are actually usable. So all the questions were sort of about some of the trade-offs and design choices and things like that, culminating with that little design problem at the end, which is more like what you'll probably be asked to do or to think about when you run into security problems or crypto problems in the real world. So the point of the first question was to actually look at the cost of RSA and to set up a story. I'm going to tell you at the end of this problem a little bit about RSA history. So first question was to compute the relative cost of encryption and decryption in terms of the modular multiplications. And all I really wanted you to focus on was the exponentiation cost, and that was one of the clarifications I did. And so, in the first problem, I said take the very common case where the public exponent is 2 to the 16th plus 1, which is almost always is. It used to be 3, and it turns out there's some bad things if you use something that's that small. So you go to 2 to the 16th plus 1, and that's sort of a good number. And how long does it take relative to do the encryption and the decryption? And the key idea here was to know that, if you remember the way in which we do modular multiplication that Josh showed, we look at the bit pattern in the exponent, and basically the top bit is always 1, and then after that, every bit position causes a square, and if you had a 1 bit, you also got to do a side multiply. So that if you're exponentiating to 5, you'll square, and then do a side multiply, and that gives you 4th plus 1, that's 5. So here we're looking at what's the cost of encrypting where I've got to raise to 2 to the 16th plus 1. Well, that's 16 bits I got to step through. It's a length of 17, and that's 16 squares, and I know there's one extra 1 bit, the bottom bit, and so I got to do a side multiply there. So that's all the cost it is. That's why it's very fast to do exponentiation to a small exponent, and especially one that's got very few 1 bits. Okay? And that's the cost of it. Now, the cost of decrypting is a lot more because remember that we have to choose, we choose E, and then we got to solve for D, and D is going to be somewhere within the range of, all the values in the group of ZP, that is the group of integers modulo P. So D is going to have roughly the same size as N. That's what's likely. You could have a lot of zero bits set at the front, but there's a 50-50 probability effectively as you go down the bits. That's not going to be the case. And so I said, assume that the length of D is 1024. Well, how many squares does that take? Well, it takes 1023 squares because you've got that many bits. And if half the bits are 1, so you've got 511 side multiples because the top bit's always going to be 1. And then the other 511 bits are going to be scattered, and wherever you hit them, you have a side multiply. So that's why it costs so much to do the decryption. Question?
I'm a little confused by that squares. For that decryption, you say it's 10 to the 3. For the encryption, you say 16. Why not for the decrypting also 10 to the 4 squares?
Because the bit length, unless I counted wrong, which I may have done, the bit length is 1024 bits.
Uh-huh.
Okay? The first bit's always 1. That doesn't give you a square. So if you write it out, and I'll be honest, the way I ended up doing this, how do I get to the whiteboard here? The whiteboard? Yeah. So if you think about it, if you were raising to like, you know, 2 to the 5th, right, that's 2 to the 101 in binary, which is you're going to do a square, you're going to square it again, and then you're going to do a side multiply, right? That's 2 to the square, you know, that's equal to 2 to the 5th, right? So you don't count that first bit. You get a square, and a side multiply. So the first bit doesn't count. If you try it out with some small numbers, you'll see that's what the value is. If you're off by one, it's not a big deal. But you'll get the same sort of rough order of magnitude. Okay, but that's kind of that's what it looks at. And so if you actually work it out for whatever it is, it's kind of. And I always check myself doing it on small numbers.
Do you calculate one? Here you calculate two square, right? And two. Do you calculate two?
Yeah, do it as x, right? If I write this as x to the fifth, that's x squared. Oh, I got it unhandled. Let's see if I can still do that. X squared squared times x.
Oh.
Did that show up?
No.
You got the pop-up. Okay. Right, so that's x squared. The square that again, that's x to the fourth times x, that's x to the fifth. Right? That answer? Okay.
Because my answer is a little bit off, like one off or something.
Not a big deal, okay? if you were way off, well, that would be, you know, and obviously I leave that up to the TAs to do grading on it, but that's kind of the answer. Okay, so we'll go back. With input. I give them input. Okay. So let's now look at this problem as rebalanced RSA. We did not talk about this in class, but there are, you know, part of the reason I wanted to introduce it here was that there are techniques that were developed to try and speed things up, right? We have a very unbalanced, what you saw in the first problem was there's a very unbalanced cost. It's real cheap to compute on the client encryption with E as a small component, and it's expensive on the server. This was a great trade-off when clients were very weak relative to servers. We have a question.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, how could anyone ever think that that was a good idea? Because servers are servicing hundreds and thousands of clients.
Yeah.
And it just seems like a bad decision.
Well, you have to really go back in time. So there's a company. Go back in time to, you know, early 90s, mid-90s, where the expectation was that the hardware sitting on the client was pretty weak and that a server could afford to invest in special-purpose cryptographic hardware to do the acceleration. But you weren't running gigahertz processors. You probably weren't even running 100 megahertz processors, right? I mean, you know, you had small capabilities on the client. And so that was seen as a fair trade-off. Now, it's also kind of, we just had RSA. These techniques did kind of come along in time. Okay, and there's a whole series of papers as to tricks to try to speed up the server side of RSA and to make things sort of more fair. And, you know, you're kind of constrained. At the end of the day, you got to do the same amount of math sort of spread. You can pick things pretty intelligently, and there's some more esoteric ways you could pick your P's and your Q's to maybe do something on the server, but this is sort of one of the more common suggestions that came out. And one I got beaten up for a while by one of the guys who did it, so and I'll tell you about that in a second. But anyway, was there another question?
I was going to ask a question actually on the previous slide.
Sure.
So it's really 15 squares and one side multiply, right?
No, it's 16 because it's 17 bits.
Okay. Sorry.
Right?
That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. I counted that one out too. Okay. I'm not above counting, okay? counting, you know. Okay, so here's this rebalanced RSA where what they do is say, look, instead of doing, you know, the full exponentiation on the server side, we know about Chinese remainder theorem. If we actually pick D first, instead of picking E to be small and letting D be, you know, whatever it has to be, pick D to be the product of two relatively small numbers. No, not so small that there's other attacks available. That's why the 160 bits is in there. Okay, that's basically to give you a minimum bound on a different type of attack. But you can just assume that that's a relatively small number. And instead of doing decryption to D, that's 1024 bits, you end up having to do two exponentiations to R1 and R2, which are only 160 bits each. You save a bunch of work. Forces the client to do more work. And so that's kind of what happens here. And so in this problem, the cost of the question was to what's the speed up and what's it cost? So when you encrypt now, you're encrypting over a full-size exponent. That is, an exponent E that is 1024 bits wide, has roughly half the bits. I said assume half the bits. And now you're going to get 1023 squares and 501 inside multiplies, which I just saw on the decryption side in the first problem. Decrypting becomes a lot faster. You have to do two exponentiations to R1 and R2. We're getting a little bit of feedback here. I don't know if anyone can hear that. To R1 and R2, and in fact, although I didn't ask you about this, the exponentiations are smaller because you're actually doing it over numbers that are about 512-bit moduluses as opposed to 1024-bit moduluses. So there's actually a second speed-up that you get underneath, okay? That's a sort of extra. But what happens is each exponentiation is going to be over 160 bits, so it's 159 squares and 79 side multiplies. So together, the work you're doing, not counting Chinese remaindering, 318 squares and 158 side multiplies. Well, that's a lot faster, right? What you get is about a 3.2x speed up on the server just by doing it this way. And this isn't hard math. All the server's doing is kind of choosing. The server controls, right? It's his public key, and he specifies his E and his D. So if the server does this, he can basically get a 3.2x speed up without changing anything else just by appropriate choice of variables. Of course, he pushes a lot more work. Question, yeah?
The value that you're exponentiating is the same for both exponents, right? You're just multiplying the C value. So why do you have to square that for both of them? I mean, can't you just reuse the squared values?
Oh, I mean, the C is going to change on a per decryption basis,
right?
For one decryption. Well, you can't save the squares because in one case it's mod P, in the other case it's mod Q. Right? So it's Chinese remaindering. Right? Let me go back.
You're right.
Right? So that's the difference. So you can't kind of save. You're right. If you happen to pick something that was a square, you know, you can do it. But then, actually, that kind of wouldn't work for the fact that it wouldn't be a product of two relatively prime numbers. So that's why you can't kind of do that. But good try. Okay, so the client's a lot slower. So you think that, geez, servers could just do this and push all the work to the client. Well, why doesn't this happen in practice? Anyone know? Anyone in Redmond know? Okay, so it turns out that there's this small bug, or I should say it was a design feature of one of the large crypto API sets that just happens to be used by Internet Explorer, where E is limited to 32 bits. Okay? And this has to do with the fact that way back when the crypto APIs inside of Windows were designed, like back in the early 90s, nobody ever had an E that was more than 2 to the 16 plus 1. So the structure actually is a D word. And the structure is not a full 1024 value. And so when folks tried to do this well, you can put out a certificate that's got a key and an E in there that's full size, and it turns out that at the time, 90%+ of the browsers in the world couldn't deal with it and couldn't make the connection because they only looked at the low 32 bits of the structure. Since this got pointed out, Dan Bonet, who's at Stanford, who actually, came up with one of these rebalancing schemes, would beat me up every summer at the crypto conference as to why not crypto API have been patched yet to basically deal with larger structures. So the moral of the story is sometimes you don't want to take the engineering design shortcuts, because you may think everyone's only going to use short exponents, but somewhere down the pipe someone's going to actually go to use something that's a big number. And this is finally being fixed in Vista. But there's things where at the time in 93, 94, no one ever thought that they would ever need to do large exponentiations on a client. It just wasn't done and it was outside. And so you design an API set for the common case. Well, things change over time.
So was anyone we know on the design team?
No, that was before my time. I mean, you may know other people that were there, but I mean, that was fixed. That was fixed even before I joined that team in 97, and it was well into it by then. And it was a reasonable choice. And, if you went and read all the RSA papers at the time, I mean, normally the exponent was 3, and then there were these short exponent attacks. And so everyone said, all right, we'll go to 2 to the 16 plus 1, but we're really not going to go more than that. We don't want more than 2 bits. because we don't want the side multiplies. We want to keep the cost on the client down as little possible.
That's kind of like saying 64K ought to be enough for anybody.
640K, but yeah. Okay.
Brian, it was a little before my time also, but only a year or two before me. But I think we can actually blame this on the RSA company, not us.
Can we blame it on RSA on the RSA libraries?
That restriction was part of the original DSafe package, yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Unfortunately, they kept beating us up. You know, as I said, Dan, and Josh knows this too, because Dan give you a hard time occasionally too, right? Right? Yeah. And of course, it's always Internet Explorer that's blamed, not actually the crypto libraries that are core to it, but, you know, be that as it may.
So I'm just curious about the fact that the client in the session negotiation only has to do this operation once, whereas the server is doing this with every client that comes in.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, like, in real life terms, back in 93, 94, how long would it have taken an average computer to do the other side of the equation, to do the server?
To do the server side? You were probably talking on the order of a small number of seconds. If I would guess. I'd have to go back actually.
And how frequently do you negotiate an SSL session?
So that's a good question. You typically only are doing that once for the duration of the connection, and you can actually save a lot of the SSL state out so that if you kind of go away and come back later, you can sort of restart the sessions up. And there have been some improvements to the SSL protocol over time to kind of let you restart. What makes this more difficult are things like load balancing servers, where, you know, the way that your typical load balancer would do, it would spread your web service requests out. But as soon as you established an SSL session, you basically were pinned to a particular server because that's the server that had your key material. So then you started seeing SSL load balancing servers where your encryption channel would terminate early at the load balancer and then get forked off and, you know, play some games there so you came through the load balancer. So there's also
another approach. There's another approach where you can just make sure that clients stay with the same SSL server that they started with, but new incoming clients get sent to different SSL servers.
That's true, and that depends upon the overall sort of behavior of what the connections are. If it's stuff that's short, you know, it's the checkout, and it's only taking someone a couple minutes typing their credit card to buy something, kind of makes sense. If you had long-term SSL connections, then you might get different behavior. You could, you know, you could starve some of your servers or something like that. A question here.
Is the assumption that the client is only using this to push a session key to the server? Because it's curious to me that there's no encrypted backlink.
What do you mean by an encrypted backlink?
We don't have RSA in the other direction.
Well, you do. Okay, so you do in the protocol, but the fact of the matter is almost nobody's doing client authentication, right? So you would get something in the other way. If you were doing client authentication, the client was doing a proof to the server, you'd get some public key operation that way.
Or if the server is using RSA to encrypt to the client.
Yeah, but that doesn't really, I mean, that's not part of SSL, right? I mean, SSL is using the public key to establish the channel, and then you've got a symmetric key that you're using. You've got a secure channel at that point.
The systems that I've used were symmetric, and so I was very surprised by the problem that it wasn't. Trying to understand what you were doing.
Well, when we get to talking about mail and how what happens in email, you'll see that, you know, you basically have sort of a more symmetric problem, so to speak, because the cost is now on the sender to basically, you know, do some encryption to all of its recipients. And, you know, it may be more balanced in that case, depending on what you do. Okay, let's move on to problem two. This was about IPsec. I hadn't intended this to really be a difficult problem, and I didn't really want people to have to delve into headers and things. The whole point of this problem was just to kind of give you a feel for the relative cost of public key operations versus symmetric operations. And so these are slightly sanitized performance numbers from sort of actual reasonable perf tests to give you a real feel. These weren't just completely made up off the spot for how long it takes to do sort of a public key negotiation and how long it takes to do sort of a symmetric operation. That's why everything's in microseconds, okay?
I think part of the problem was that the word packet means something very different to us than it does to you.
Well, yes.
Session everywhere, it would have been easier.
Well, or vice versa. And well, yes, but you're correct, I shouldn't use packet, so I apologize for the confusion. So the first question was, okay, let's assume that the way in which the operation works is that you send... you're sending data a kilobyte at a time. And to do that, the point was you had to do an IP negotiation that was going to involve a public key op, and then you had to do a bunch of symmetric operations on the 1 kilobyte of data. And how long would that take? And then bandwidth being bits per second, and so you do one IP, that takes you 25,000 microseconds. You've got a kilobyte, and you encrypt it 16 bytes at a time, so that's 64 blocks that you got to do. It's 0.25 microseconds for each of those. That's 16 microseconds. So the full time is 25,016 microseconds. Really dwarfed by the public key operations. This is kind of like why we don't like to do public key a lot relative to symmetric operations. So that's at 1024 bytes, 4,933 bytes per second. I did not express these in kilobyte terms because I could have done this one in kilobytes, but when it gets to megabytes, there's, is it a million bytes? Is it a 1024000, et cetera? So I just gave you exact byte numbers. I have a question here.
Drop by three orders of magnitude bytes per second.
No?
No. I don't think I am.
Oh, that's right on.
It's about 41 kilobytes per second. Microseconds, 10 to the minus 6. Am I off?
Yeah, I think off.
Yes, it's 1,000 bytes in 25 seconds.
It's 1,000 bytes in 0.02 in 0.025.
Microseconds, sorry.
Microseconds.
Yeah, it's milliseconds all the way
down.
Okay. All right. Yeah, powers of 10 kind of kill you as well. All right, so let's go on to 2. Okay, so now let's say that you want to be more of an engineer about it and you actually want to take into account the cost of the additional headers you add. And again, let's just look at the cost of ESP. And I said, all right, assume you add 56 bytes to ESP. And again, this is kind of a little fake in the sense that it doesn't deal with packet fragmentation and max packet size and things like that. But let's just kind of look at what that cost is. So now you're sending 1,080 bytes to actually transmit 1024 bytes of data. And you got to say, well, what's the reduction? And you don't really know what the wire speed is. So the way I chose to do it this time was to look at the ratio and assume that there's an appropriate reduction in the actual throughput at that point. So if I got to send, let me see if I can put yellow here. If I got to send 1080 to really send 1024, and I'm sending 1024 out, then I'm getting effectively 970.9 bytes per. And that reduces it to 38811. bytes per second. Okay, there's a couple of different ways you look at that, but that's the relative reduction you'd see if you took the headers into account. Not a huge deal; it's a few percent. Okay, but not a large amount. If you go up to 100 kilobyte amounts, let's say, or look at the limiting case, and you'll see that it actually makes sort of almost no difference, right? In the 100 kilobyte case, you're doing still one IC negotiation. That's 25,000 microseconds. You've got to do 6,400 block encryptions. That's 1,600 microseconds. So now you're up to 26,600 microseconds. And that gives you 3.8 million bytes per second when you calculate that out. And again, depending on how you express this as megabytes and kilobytes and what you sued, you could do, end up with like 3.79 megabytes or 3.8 megabytes or what have you. If you count it, and here I took it, and of course I took 100K as 102400. Different people might, I mean, that seems like a reasonable assumption of 100K, although I'm sure someone out there would say, well, it's actually slightly different, it should be 100,000 or what have you. And if you work that out, then you see there's a slight drop if you actually take the headers into account, but it's not a big deal. In the limit, what's the limiting factor? The limiting factor is how fast you can do block encryption, right? So I can do block encryption at 0.25 microseconds, ignoring everything else, then I'm sending 64 million bytes per second, okay? And if I have special purpose hardware that does that faster, which is why you see special purpose hardware on network cards, so that, you know, you never have your encryption hopefully being your limiting factor, you know, that's the limiting factor of the big case. But obviously, fragmentation issues, the more often you have to do a public key negotiation, the more it costs, the more it's going to slow things down. And you want sort of lightweight as opposed to heavyweight bytes. That was sort of the point of the question. Are there questions on this one? Other room? Yes.
In all of these protocols, we have public key encryption, which encrypts a session key, which is then used symmetrically. And in some of the other assignments, we've assumed that we're just using public key encryption. Is it always the case that the public key protects a private key that's symmetric, and then the private key is used to encrypt gobs and gobs of data? Or is it ever the case that the public key is used to encrypt the whole message?
It is almost always the case that it's the former, that you're using public key to protect a random symmetric key, and you're using that for bulk encryption. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is, you know, if it's generally you don't have very small amounts. There might be some cases. Josh, I'm trying to think if there's anything in a standard protocol. What?
Not so much in common protocols that I can think of, but in a month I'll be speaking of some more exotic uses of public key cryptography in cases where you've got sort of multicast or multi-person protocol kinds of things, and each participant uses a public key encryption that they put together in various ways. So yes, there are cases where you encrypt things other than a session key, but they're not really in common use.
Everything you're going to run into in all the common cases, we're doing in exchange to exchange a random session key, and then we're using that for bulk encryption just because it's so much faster. And that's just sort of what you're like. That's sort of the practical aspects of the problem. So the third question, unless there's any other questions on two, was this notion of I wanted to try and introduce some threat models. So assume we have a Kerberos realm, and we have a client, a server, and a KDC, and the KDC eavesdrops, right? And we know from the description of Kerberos that the KDC basically has access to the keys that it hands out, and therefore could see all the traffic. And the idea was, assume that you've got this Kerberos realm in existence. Can you come up with a protocol that allows a client and a server to exchange a key that only they know, given that the only sort of way they have of authenticating each other, which was kind of the point, was that they've got this Kerberos key between them. Okay, so, well, key establishment's real easy, right? We have Diffie-Hellman, right? Diffie-Hellman's our tool for doing key agreements. And you can do it with RSA too, but here, so this is one way to do it. There are many different possible solutions to this problem. I'm going to present one, and I'm sure there's others, and we can even talk about more at the break. I have a question here.
Well, just, wouldn't you say, though, that Diffie-Hellman's better in this case? Because RSA implies that there's an existing PKI that you said nothing about. Right?
Well, not necessarily. It might. Let me show you how I solved this one, and then you'll kind of see where I'm leading. Okay. The key question with all of these, right, is how did, if CNA, so some people ask me, said, well, can't I just run Diffie-Hellman? Right? Ignore the whole Kerberos realm. Right? Well, sure, CNS can run Diffie-Hellman, but how do you prove to the other party that they're who they say they are?
The Kerberos server told us.
Well, how did the Kerberos server tell you that? The Kerberos server gave you a shared secret, right? Now, assume that you've done that. Now the client walks up to the server and all of a sudden presents some parameters. How does the server know that that's actually the client for with whom he had just gotten, you know, exchanged a ticket? Right, that was part of the point of the question, was how do you sort of leverage the fact that you've done a secret key exchange? That secret key isn't good for encryption, though, because there's someone else who knows it. But if you know that guy's passive, it can be used for authentication. Okay?
Well, that's kind of what I was saying there, is that we trust the Kerberos server to not interfere since it's passive, right?
Right.
And we trust that it knows both of us, and it's given us a key that we can thereby identify each other. We can authenticate each endpoint, right?
Okay.
Because we trust the Kerberos server, but we don't trust it to not eavesdrop on our communication. So once we've got that, then we can use Diffie-Hellman to then exchange something that's secret amongst ourselves.
And so long as you can show how you use the Kerberos key to prove that when the Diffie-Hellman parameters come in, they're from who you thought they came from.
Okay.
Because remember, there's other people out there. Imagine that you've got wrong one. And
sure, yeah, you encrypt your session with the server with the key that you got from the KDC.
Right. Imagine you've got two clients, and you've got an evil client over here, and you have a KDC, and you play, you know, Kerberos this way, and these guys establish KCS. And now this guy's gonna do a Diffie-Hellman presentation.
He encrypts it with KCS, right?
Well, that's one way to do it. Okay, there's a couple different ways. I'm going to show you a slightly different technique.
Okay.
But the key question is, how does the server know when he gets this inbound packet, this inbound data, that it's coming from C and not coming from C prime? Okay, that's the question. Okay, and let me swap back. So Kerberos Core gives you this mutual lock for free, and the question is, you know, how can you leverage that? So here's one way to do it. And I gave you this hint about HVAC SHA-1. Okay, so here's one way to do it where you use an HVAC. What you do is you have, change colors. You have the server and the client run Diffie-Hellman. Okay, so first they run Kerberos and they establish that secret. Now they run what's called ephemeral Diffie-Hellman. They're going to randomly pick, you know, secret exponents, raise the generator to it, come up with public exponents. And now, when they exchange their public values, they also send along this keyed map. Okay? Keyed maps are nice because what they do is they're basically hash values that mix in some secret material. So they can only be verified by somebody else who happens to have the secret. So this is an authenticator. This value here is an authenticator for that value, and it proves to the server who receives it that it's coming from the client. Because only the client could have generated the HMAC, because only the client knows that value. Now, anybody else on the wire who was playing man in the middle would see A, and they could generate their own HMAC, right? They could just replace A or do something else, but they can't regen the HMAC to make it match, because only those two points at the endpoint. I have a question here.
Your question, the question was specifically about the KDC eavesdropping. So basically, my answer to this question was exactly use Kerberos for authentication by running Diffie-Hellman, let's say. Because the question wasn't implying that there is another malicious party in the roles.
Oh, so you interpreted it as there was only three parties on the network period?
Yeah. Well, 3A also said that we were only worrying in 3A about passive attacks, right? You said that.
Did I say passive from everyone or passive from the KDC?
And then 3B and C were when you approached the idea of.
Active attacks.
Okay, so I
this tend, protects against active attacks, right?
There's sort of two things going on. There's the KDC eavesdropping, right? Which, once you've established the Diffie-Hellman key agreement, you've gotten a key that only they depend upon. You've also got, how does the server know that the client is who it says it is? That's sort of a general authentication problem you have.
But I thought we already authenticated through Kerberos. We trust the KDC to send
it. Sure. So the server and the client, anything that is communicated using the key they've agreed upon, they know is coming from each other.
So you already know that. And you trust the KDC to...
If you use that key then to protect, say, some further information. So like you were talking about earlier, if I run Diffie-Hellman, but I actually send the Diffie-Hellman values encrypted with the key, yes, then because what you're doing there is you're leveraging the fact that there's this... Yeah. That the fact the key's been agreed upon, right? If I just send Diffie-Hellman values, then I don't have any knowledge of whose they come from.
Yeah.
That's kind of the difference. Okay, I'll take your follow up and then his.
Yeah, my point is that basically, I think Kerberos, what you're explaining with signing essentially the messages with the keyed hash is nothing specific to this situation in particular. Basically, after you do authentication through Kerberos, throughout the whole next conversation, you have to sign up everything, right? Otherwise, what's the point of authenticating just in the beginning and then sending messages? So it's nothing, it's not specific to... Basically, we could say that we did authentication through Kerberos and then continue in the context of Kerberos continuing conversation, which...
And that would have been an acceptable answer. If you said that once you've established the Kerberos key, that within the secured channel that had been established by Kerberos, you then exchange Diffie-Hellman parameters to exchange another key, that would have been okay. That's an okay answer too. Right, there's a bunch of ways. Someone pointed out to me in one of the communications over the weekend that part of the Kerberos protocol itself allows you to pass optional information in it. And you could actually, if you had access to the Kerberos protocol itself and can modify your Kerberos stack, you could actually pass the Diffie-Hellman parameters along as part of the Kerberos negotiation if you wanted to. But I didn't specify one way or another whether you could change the Kerberos protocol or not. So there's a lot of ways to do it. But you've negotiated a key, and then you have to, within the context of that authentication, or you have to use that key to authenticate parties. Either way. Any other questions on this one? You had a question.
I think you already asked. I was going to ask if this is equivalent in strength.
So basically, signing A with KCS and passing MCM to B.
Well, you got to tell me what you mean by signing with this
metric. I mean encrypting. Sorry.
You could encrypt it with KCS. And that would roughly be the same level strength, because you'd basically have to break the encryption, or you've got to break the HVAC. And we could probably argue on the edges as to, you know, within a couple of bits of difficulty, but, you know, assuming that you've got a strong symmetric algorithm there, yeah, it's probably equivalent. Okay, any other questions on this one? Okay, 3B, why doesn't this work if the KDC is active? All right. Anyone?
KDC can impersonate both sides.
That's right. If KDC is active, it can play man in the middle, and it can rewrite messages, and in fact...
It's got the key, too, so it can...
It could take my protocol that I just presented, and it could generate HMAX, right? Here you go, the KDC can sit in the middle here, it can play a classic man in the middle attack, and even if you've got HMAX, the KDC could play the HMAX against both sides, and the client necessarily would be completely fooled. Okay? Now, based on whatever protocol you came up with for 3A, you may have a slightly different answer, but unless there's anyone who thinks they actually found a way to do this where the answer to B was it protects against an active attack, I'd be surprised if that was the case. And if so, you should come see me later. We might have use of your protocol. You know, in this case, that was kind of what I was looking for, something similar along those lines based on whatever your solution to 3A was. Okay? Now, the extra credit was, okay, so how do you defend against inactive attack? And in 3C was, you know, assume one of the parties are active, but they don't collude. Because if you've got two KDCs colluding, it's kind of like back to what I had in 3A. It's just I've got more machines over there. And there's a lot of different ways you can leverage the fact that CNS now have two keys they've exchanged. So they both have both keys. A KDC's only got one of them. And so, obviously, you kind of want to think about ways in which you could combine it so that you use both keys to do the authentication. And so, you know, you've got to just come up with sort of a way to mix in both of the keys. And I just took the mechanism that I used previously and basically did my HMAC over, and you can read this as, so I there's a bug here. This should be like KCS1 concatenated with KCS2. But what you want to do is you basically want to mix in both sets of key materials. Now, you could do something where you mix the keys together and encrypted with a combination of both of them or something like that. There's a number of different things you could do, but that's kind of the general idea of the extra credit problem. Have a question?
Can we just use one key, for example, in the RAM 1, we use key 2. In RAM 2, we use key 1.
You could use that if you knew that the communications couldn't be seen by both KDCs. So that depends kind of on your physical networking. That's sort of outside the bounds of the problem, right? I mean, I kind of assume that all network traffic is sort of freely available to anybody who watches. I mean, given current NSA behavior, that's probably a reasonable assumption, you know? You know, if you want to see. Question over here.
Well, similarly, couldn't you nest them, like encrypt with one and then encrypt with the other one, and then you still need to have both to decrypt it, but you wouldn't be introducing them.
You could, and that's gonna, you know, that depends upon that collusion bit, right? You could double encrypt one of the KDCs, whoever the KDC is on the outer, right, will be able to decrypt it, and guess what? He's gonna find, he gets it halfway, right? You know, and if they're colluding, you've got bigger problems. So yeah, that would be another way to do it. Other questions? Regman question, yeah.
The nice thing about using Diffie-Hellman in 3C is that if the KDCs decide to collude later on, they can't see your entire conversation by playing, you know, recording it and then playing it back and combining their information. Diffie-Hellman gives you a secret that they can't find out after the fact.
Right, that's something called perfect forward secrecy, which also... We're not going to get to it tonight, but hopefully later on in the class we'll talk about sort of some variants of Diffie-Hellman. There's sort of two ways when you play Diffie-Hellman. You can play it with either, in this case, ephemeral keys where you just choose a random value every time, or you can also play static Diffie-Hellman where you've actually got a fixed public key. And sometimes you want to mix those and you'll actually do two Diffie-Hellmans intertwined, one of each to sort of preserve that purpose forward secrecy property that you mentioned. And yeah, it's a nice thing about this one, right? I just do a Diffie-Hellman, I get a random key, it's good for my thing, I throw it away, doesn't help them with anything moving further on. Right? It's cool. All right.
Is there any way to solve 3A without using public key?
To solve 3A without doing, so you're going to do some sort of a symmetric, I'd have to think that one through. I don't believe so, but I'm not sure I can prove it to you. I have to think if I can prove it to you. Okay.
And on the first question, do the R1s and R2s have to be sufficiently large, I guess?
Yeah, so going back to question one, the reason that I said 160 bits was because one of the possible attacks against RSA is based on the square root of the size. It's basically a square root attack, which means that the complexity of the attacks is exponential in the square root of the size of the number. So if I use 160 bit, I think I've described that right. The point is, if I have a 160 bit number, then the complexity of the attack is 2 to the 80. Okay? And so if I use very small R's, if my R's were like, well, geez, why am I not using 64 bit quantities? Well, it turns out somebody can attack a 2 to the 32 time, which is fast. 2 to the 80 is kind of still assumed to be, you know, reasonably difficult for mere mortals, right? You know, and actually for folks, yeah, that's sort of our lower bound right now on what we're willing to live with, although none of us really like it at 2 to the 80, right? I'd rather be up to 2 to the 128, but that's why it was set to 160. Okay? If you remember when we talked about the DSA, we talked about the digital signature algorithm, right? DSA, briefly. So in DSA, there's a subgroup that's also set to 160 bits, and it's for that same property, because an attack there against DSA that is proportional to the square root of the size. Other questions? All right, so we've run a little long. So let's dive in. I'm going to probably try to go a little bit faster through some of the initial material, so that we can get through stuff, because I don't want to get hung up on IPsec. So I'm going to blow through things. I won't blow through things really fast, but we'll try to move a little bit faster. Goal for today, we're going to finish up IPsec key management, and then we're going to go off to message-based protocols. We're going to talk about secure mail and XML encrypting and digital signatures. So let's go back, and I'm going to rewind and walk you through IPsec, and we'll do this a little bit faster. Remember from what we were doing last time that in IPsec, there's this notion of doing the key management to establish a session, this thing called a security association between two endpoints. And then once you do that, we're encrypting traffic, and you have to play with some of that. Security associations are, you know, this new concept as far as IP communication was concerned. It represents an exchange of parameters. And we tag packets with pointers to a security association so the recipient knows which SA he needs to use and which set of parameters to decrypt. And setting up these SAs is where the key exchange comes in, what's called IKE. Okay? And so, you know, I explained last time how you go about, once you've got one of these things, actually doing the packet encryption. Well, now we're going to go back and say, well, what does that mean to set up and establish a security association? And basically, they're all flavors of Diffie-Hellman. And the question is, how much Diffie-Hellman do you want to do, and how aggressive do you want to be about it, and how much can you assume? And because of the cost of the public key operations relative to the symmetric operations, there's a lot of attempt in the IPsec protocols to try to stay within the symmetric domain whenever you can. So you have to rekey every so often, but you'll see that one of the modes allows the two parties, once they've established an SA through public key negotiation, to actually go back and say, okay, we're going to rekey, but we're going to rekey while we're still within the symmetric encryption, bulk encryption, before our key kind of times out and we decide we can't use it anymore. And so this is another thing that is sort of common in a lot of engineering practices, where you'll pay the heavy cost once, and so long as you believe the symmetric encryption key is still valid, right, in terms of its lifetime, you'll use it to go, you'll do another one under the covers. Now that doesn't give you the property that the gentleman from Redmond was talking about a moment ago, which is this notion that every time you do a public key op, you sort of terminate the ability of someone who has recorded the prior conversation to learn something useful about the next one. So again, there's some engineering trade-offs between how often do I rekey within a context and how often do I negotiate a new context. And folks have different security policies about that. Question.
So when you do rekey in that symmetric context, does someone just choose a random value? And
I'll show you in a moment. So hold that thought. It's called quick mode.
Okay.
Okay, as opposed to main mode or aggressive mode.
Okay. That would be public key.
Which is public key. Okay. The general idea of IKV2 is you're doing Diffie-Hellman. Basically, by exchanging public key values and some nonces, and once you've done the exchange of values, that's what happens here, then you use the shared secret to encrypt some stuff that identifies who you are and proof that you are who you say you are. That's the general idea of all of these. And exactly how many messages and negotiations gets into a little bit more of the engineering. So that's IKV2, and we'll see how that comes about. Ike's all about, geez, it seems pretty simple. Choose some cryptographic keys, reset some sequence numbers so you know what packet sequence you are inside of a security association, and then authenticate your endpoints. Well, I just showed it to you on one page, right? That can't be that hard. I mean, it's just simple, right? It's taken 10 years for this to get through the IETF. And I'm going to try to channel Charlie Kaufman, who actually is one of my coworkers at Microsoft, who sits and has been part of this for years and has a long discourse on the politics of IPsec. But let me give you a flavor for sort of, you know, some of the things that have happened in our attempt to kind of bring, and I mean the industry's attempt to bring security to IPsec. If you go back about 10 years ago, there were a couple of proposals for how to do key negotiation that were all basically Diffie-Hellman variants. One was by Phil Karnen, it was called Futurus. There's another one called Skip, and I forget who did Skip exactly. And these were basically variants either doing signed Diffie-Hellman exchange of the parameters, where you'd do with ephemeral Diffie-Hellman, but each party would have a key that would sign the Diffie-Hellman values, or you had certified Diffie-Hellman public keys, so when I talked to you, I always used your fixed Diffie-Hellman key value. That's the difference between a static and an ephemeral Diffie-Hellman. An ephemeral I generate on the fly, a static I kind of know what your fixed key is. And they were kind of battling it out and going back and forth, and the winner was this thing called ISAC AMP that parachuted in from the NSA. And it was a gift from the NSA. And actually, I believe I will say, and as Josh has said before, I believe the NSA actually meant well, okay? But it was a framework for doing protocol design. And as those of you who have read any sort of specs know, as soon as you introduce the word framework, you're now at a meta level that people can plug a lot of things in, and complexity tends to go up as the square of the cube of the number of paragraphs in the spec. And so, all of a sudden, we are now talking about multiple phases, where phase one key negotiation was expensive, basically doing Diffie-Hellman. Phase two was cheap, where you were doing this, once you've established a session, do another derivation inside. Okay, so, and then they call this ISAC AMP SA agreement versus IPsec SA agreement, and we got more wording and terminology turned around, and the stack of specs kept growing. And there was this other thing called Oakley, which was another key exchange component, and so the authors of the spec were trying to fit all these things in, and as common happens when you want to have rough consensus and running code, which is the IETF model, you end up having to basically allow people to do a lot of their own thing. You kind of reach consensus by making ORs. You add ORs to the spec. You add choices. You add options. So there was this attempt to rewrite, and you ended up with basically three specs on ISAC AMP, the key negotiation, and something called the domain of influence that I still don't quite understand, plus things on NAT traversal, and we got an even larger pack of specs. And I'll take the question here.
How is the authentication done?
So this was effectively, I'll pop back and give you the basic idea. Let's see if I can pop back here. So if I go all the way back to this stage, when this proof that gets sent here is basically authenticating to Bob that Alice is actually at this end. And that could be either because Alice is performing something using a private key that corresponds to a certified public key, or because there's actually a Kerberos domain involved as well and Alice has picked something in.
So there's additional
information. Yeah, there are actually, if you actually go deeper, and I kind of aligned this, but you go deeper into the specs, these modes all kind of existed in three variants. A shared password, a pre-shared password variant, Kerberos variant, and a certified public key variant. Okay? So the assumption was that once you hit this point, you know, you're now talking about, I've got nodes that somehow have a way to authenticate each other. Okay? And we'll talk about what actually gets used in a bit. And it was always Kerberos, public key, or passwords. Because, again, you want to bring everybody on board, and you weren't going to force anyone to do one or the other. So, true quote from RFC 2409, which is one of the specs. While Oakley defines modes, ISACAMP defines phases. The relationship between the two is very straightforward, and Ike presents different exchanges as modes which operate in one of two phases. 150 pages of that, okay? Kind of not hard to understand what happened. In ISACAMP, there was this notion that you had a protocol, two modes, and you can hide lots of things. And there was, and I'll walk you through aggressive and main and quick in a second. But there were lots of different protocols that you had to introduce, and this just leads to complexity, okay? If you ever are involved in a standards environment, I beg you, please, don't succumb to the tyranny of OR, as they say, which is two camps that can't agree, and so you just say either one's okay. Because every time you introduce that, your test matrix kind of blows up. And it just, you get these things, you get specs out where so much is left open that you don't know what the heck the other endpoint actually speaks. Okay? Just a practical, because I've been through enough standard stuff to have seen the dark side of, well, sure, we can just add another choice. What's it matter? Right? And that's kind of what happens. Question over here.
Have you heard of a product called OpenVPN?
I have heard of it. I haven't studied it deeply.
I've just noticed, because of these complexity issues that you're talking about, it's starting to become preferred by network administrators out there because it's just a lot simpler to set up than an IPsec.
Is that a VPN based on SSL?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of that going on. So what one of the side effects was IPsec was supposed to be the new VPN technology. Because it kind of got to be so difficult to set up, we have started to see a rise in SSL-based VPNs. They also happen to tunnel better when you're on the road and things like that. I will say that I have great respect for the UI designers who have to try and create security policy UI to represent IPsec security policies. They have a very hard task, okay, to try and make sense of this to someone who's configuring things. And you go through a lot of trial and error when you're trying to set one of these up. Anyway, let me walk you quickly through aggressive mode, main mode, and what have you. In aggressive mode, we're basically going to do a Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and in the process, we're going to send some proof of who we are. That's some of these authenticators, either Kerberos, shared secret, or public key. The public key value we choose, and a nonce. Bob sends that back, and then Alice sends a proof. So notice that Alice does an announce here. Bob does an announce and a proof in one mode, in one message, and then Alice does a proof back. So there's sort of a commit phase. If we get to talk about sort of two-phase commits and some of that stuff, or how we do bit commitment schemes later, you'll see this too. You sort of commit to what you're going to prove, and then you prove it so that you don't kind of swap out and, you know, have one party mimicking another. That's aggressive mode. What normally happens when you initialize is a thing called main mode, where we have the full suite of trying to agree upon a set of ciphers that folks understand. So the first step is always a proposal, just like in SSL. Here's the cipher suites I understand. These are the algorithms I have. This is what I'm willing to support. Pick something, and, you know, Alice says to Bob, here's what I've got. Pick something out of that to use. And Bob says, okay, I'm going to choose this one. Then we do a Diffie-Hellman exchange. Here, with some nonces, Alice sends a proof across with this, where the way that she proves that she is who she says she is varies based on what the authentication scheme is in place between the two machines, whether it's Kerberos. You can imagine if it's Kerberos-based, that there's some Kerberos authentication going on here. If it was a password-based, there's some password-based authentication. And then Bob sends a proof back, and he's got a key variant dependent here, too, as he sends something back. That's main mode in a nutshell. And I won't go into any more details than that. What most folks actually do, even though they support Kerberos and even though they support public key, is hard-coded passwords into the endpoints, what's called pre-shared key tests. Okay, that's exactly what happens. Okay, so we run main mode and we assume that there is some secret that has been typed into the two routers that are doing the VPN tunnel, or been typed into the machines. Anything else is really rare, to be honest. It happens, and it gets used, but this is by far the most common scenario. So again, Cypher Suite exchange in order to reach agreement on what protocols we're going to talk about. Then we do a Diffie-Hellman exchange of parameters. And then, just like what we saw in problem 3, where we used a shared secret as an authenticator in HMAC, what happens here is there's this function that mixes in, and this could be an HMAC, or it could be an encryption function with a derived key, where I mix in the pre-shared secret and the key that I've agreed upon just then. So notice what happens is every time you run this protocol between two endpoints, you're going to get a different, let me erase that here, you're going to get a different output here out of this function. That value is going to be different because this input here that you'll have agreed upon is randomly generated. So you're mixing in a value S that is fixed and known to the two endpoints plus a random value every time. And that helps change for the way protocol runs. Okay, I have a question here.
You're using that to encrypt the Alice I'm proof of Alice?
You can use, yeah.
As indicated by your curly
yes.
braces?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Okay. I believe it's used in encrypt. You could imagine that you could also do something like you did a keyed MAC with it or something like that. But at that point, you might as well use it to encrypt. Okay. Other questions? All right. In quick mode, the idea behind quick mode is imagine that you've done this key establishment once. Okay. And that having done so, we're now speaking underneath the protection of some SA, and what we want to do is now say, okay, it's time to rekey, but before our current key expires, let's just generate something new so we don't have to go back and do public key encryption anymore. And what they basically do is, so Y is this random value that's used just to link these three messages together, and they send a nonce across.
Generates the nonce.
Alice generates the initial nonce NI, so NI starts here, NR starts over there with Bob. So they each pick a random nonce, they send it across to each other, and then what happens is they take their current key, they could also do an ephemeral Diffie-Hellman if they wanted to and mix it in. But they take their current key and they mix it into a pseudo-random function that's defined, kind of works like the pseudo-random function we saw in SSL, with the two nonces, and that gives them a new key. So you see what you're doing here is you're taking your current key forward in the simplest case where you actually don't have that value. You take your current key, you mix in two nonces, you basically see the pseudo-random number generator take a new 16 bytes out of it, or 32 bytes, or however much long you need, and that's your new key. Now note that anybody who gets your current key and is recording all the traffic would now know what the new key was, and they could play the traffic forward, okay? Because they've got all the information. But that allows you to basically do a rekey in place, and that's commonly done inside of IPsec.
GAB is not used in there.
Well, that's one way. There's two variants, of course, because again, it's IPsec, therefore everything's a variant. In the second mode, where I actually send across these two values and they're present in these two phases, they get combined and you mix that value in here. Okay, and that's the only other difference. Which actually, again, helps defend against somebody who is eavesdropping if they happen to have a current key. I'm going to skip. I think we'll take the break because it's 7:30. The remaining slides that I had here were basically an additional topic on sort of bundling and, I'll tell you what, we'll walk through it in like 2 minutes, all right, and we'll take the break. The whole point of IPsec bundling is that because of the way IPsec is defined, you can wrap IPsec inside of IPsec, and so it's easy to get tunnel mode wrapping transport mode. And so all these slides were basically going through was the fact that you can start and have a machine that starts sending something in transport mode and get an IPsec packet, and that may hit an IPsec tunnel, and you'd then be wrapping the transport mode in tunnel mode, and then when you receive it in tunnel mode, it takes it apart, and receives it in transport mode, and you take that apart. And look at the slides if you want, but it's basically very straightforward. The only other thing I was going to talk through, which I'll just again speed through, network address translation plays havoc with IPsec. You can't do AH with network address translation because you're trying to rewrite. NAT tries to rewrite and port address translation, trying to rewrite IP addresses and ports, and you just can't do that. Here's sort of a standard picture of doing NAT intercept and doing a rewrite. and it
becomes encrypted. Is that why
you can't? You can't do it because you break the hash value for the authenticator. If you're strictly in AH mode, you've got a hash value here that applies and covers the header, and you've just rewritten the header.
Yeah.
Okay, that breaks it. In encryption mode, there are a couple of ways. There's apparently a way to use some pseudo values that get ignored, and so they basically patched around the NAT stuff to do it. So you can do some with ESP, but basically, you know, rewriting IP addresses kind of doesn't play nice, and there's a bunch of hackiness that has to happen. Now, the IPv6 folks will tell you, well, that's why you should use IPv6, so you don't have to do NAT. So you've got, you know, as many addresses as you could possibly want. We live in an IPv4 world, and we seem to for the time being. So let's take the break. We'll come back at 37 past, and we'll start it on message-based protocols. So we're going to shift gears now, and for the rest of the night, we're going to talk about message-based protocols. Yeah? Redmond? Oh, I just... Okay. Okay. Because we spent the last session, and as I ran you through quickly some stuff on session-based, and really, this comes down to the difference between synchronous and asynchronous protocols. Session-based protocols, I've got two parties or N parties, oh, I have to stay in a few, right, who, you know, are engaging in real-time communication, can exchange messages back and forth. But in a message-based protocol, and again, think mail, you don't have that, right? You're in this mode where it's fire and forget, where I want to send you an encrypted message, and I better know what your capabilities are, and I have to sort of package up everything that you're going to need to be able to decrypt it, and so that you and only you can decrypt it when I send that message out onto the network, because I don't necessarily have that chance to communicate back and forth. And that basically makes you think differently about how you design the protocols and where you're willing to spend time, because you may be willing to do more work because it's asynchronous on the send side, for example. There's lots of message-based protocols in the world. We're going to focus on mail because it's by far the most common. If I think about things like remote procedure calls, that's a message-based protocol. It's asynchronous. You know, routing table updates. Anytime where I'm doing something and it's even async I/O inside a system, message passing inside a grid computer. These are all asynchronous messaging protocols. And you can think about security for those all in the same way, that I have to be able to apply some protection on the outbound side, and I may get a message back that says it wasn't, you know, decodable. I may have to know something at a time. I can't depend upon any sort of a real-time agreement or any short latency agreement. And email is by far the most common. And as we talked about earlier, even though we've been working at signed and encrypted email for a long time, usability and uptake is still kind of low. Okay. How many people regularly send and receive? I think we did this, right? Sign an encrypted email on a regular basis. Okay, I got one here and maybe a few in Redmond, maybe. Okay, I do.
Not a one.
One, okay. Not a lot, right? And even the uptake in general communication, right? People post price lists on the web. They don't sign them. Right? How do you know they're actually valid? You don't even get them over an SSL connector. You've got no authentication most of the time, right? You know, how do you know that those results you're getting from the website are really coming from the website if it's not inside of SSL? You can't persist anything, right? Let's say you make a purchase order off the web and you get a doc back. How often does somebody actually sign that to commit to that purchase order? Never. You know, these sorts of things kind of don't happen. At best, we have wide deployment of SSL for communication security, but not for persistence. And so we're going to walk through how the technology works and, you know, how the what the design looks like and what some of the design goals were. And we'll talk about S-line first, and then we'll talk about XML and how that kind of changed things, because there's a progression, there's a natural progression from the way in which people approached mail to the way in which people approached arbitrary XML objects. So what is S-line? Well, it stands for Secure MIME. MIME stands for Multipurpose Internet Mail Extensions. MIME is the standard for how basically you send mail that is anything more than straight text. Okay? How many people actually have looked at like a MIME message and know, if I say MIME, does that say, okay, so some of you, a lot of you have, right? Everyone's received MIME, because if you ever receive a mail, you know, you receive that piece of spam that's got the big graphical image, you know, with whatever, and then there's the salad at the bottom. You know, the word salad, that's the hash of words to get around the spam filter. That's a multi-purpose internet. That's a MIME message. Because you've mixed graphics and text. And what MIME basically tells you how to do is how to take a bunch of different elements, be they graphic, audio, straight text, HTML, what have you, and combine them together into a single mail message that then can get sent through the 7-bit clean, you know, mail service that exists in the world. SMIME was an attempt to provide, and is the way in which we provide signature services and encryption services on MIME messages. So it actually takes in a MIME message and gives you back a MIME message. If you think of SMIME as a transform, it takes in a multi-part message and gives you back a multi-part message. It is also a multi-part itself, so you can take an SMIME component and mix it with things that are not part of SMIME and get a larger MIME message. So it's completely wrappable. It was a standards effort that was led by a vendor, basically. It was led by RSA, who owned the patents, of course, on, you know, RSA Data Security Incorporated, which had the patents on RSA, led an effort very early on, before there was sort of any IETF standardization of crypto, to standardize things like signature formats and some public key encryption formats and a signed and encrypted mail format. And it got transferred into the IETF and is now, you know, an Internet RFC. It is the thing that almost everybody uses when they talk about signing encrypted mail. The alternative format is PGP, of which I've been a user for a long time as well. At the level that we're going to talk about these things, PGP and SMIME both basically do roughly the same cryptographic operations. The formats are different. The key trust hierarchies are completely different, and we'll talk about the differences when I do my third lecture on PKI and trust. But for the purposes of actually forming things, you could think about PGP too. Okay. Well, but you know, SMIME tends to be that's the more of the standard. PGP actually is an IETF standard as well. It's not as widely supported. So there's a fundamental scenario assumption when you're thinking about SMIME, which is that every user's got two keys, two key pairs. Okay, a signing key pair and an encryption key pair. So we're already in a realm that's a little bit different from, you know, sort of your standard IPsec key negotiation and that sort of thing, where there's this fundamental notion of what's called separation of duty. Signing keys and encryption keys should not mix. Now, early on, when it was RSA leading the effort and having one key pair was a big deal, because it took you a while to generate that key pair on a very slow machine, you know, there were folks who would use the same key for dual purposes. But most of the folks who care about signed and encrypted mail really want the key separate. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is they like to escrow the encryption keys. Okay, you're an employee of a corporation and you get hit by that crosstown beer truck and you no longer have access to your encryption key. Company wants to be able to get out your encrypted stuff. So within corporate environments, you hear about, you know, escrowed encryption. When we talk about politics at the end of the class, we'll talk about the government's attempts to cause everybody to escrow their keys in 94 and how that failed. But that's sort of a separate thing. But that's one common thing. You want to escrow encryption keys in certain settings because you want backup. You don't want to escrow signing keys. So what's it mean if I escrow a signing key? I give you the right to sign something as me. There's sort of no reason for that. And in fact, one of the biggest proponents of the separation of duty and the escrow of encryption keys and the absolutely never possibly escrow of signing keys is the U.S. military. Okay? In the U.S. military, what they're rolling out are smart cards that are what they call common access cards that are signing keys. And in the military, when you sign for stuff, it has legal effect. Okay? Paymasters, who are pay people, they sign electronically for stuff, and like you're personally liable and responsible for the cash that you receive as a paymaster to distribute to somebody else, and if the cash goes missing, you're like held personally liable for it. And they absolutely don't want signing keys ever archived or obtainable or kept on floppies or anything like that. You know, you are your signing key in that scenario. Encryption keys, they absolutely want archived. So there's that sort of separation. Okay. For the purposes of tonight's lecture, I'm going to assume, and this is a big assumption, key distribution is not a problem. That is, if I want to send you a signed and encrypted email message, I can get hold of your public encryption key, and I believe it's yours, and you are able to get hold of my signature, my public signature key, and believe it's from me. Because again, we'll talk about key distribution a little bit later, but for the purposes of tonight, assume that the key distribution happens, and now we want to talk about the mechanics of how that goes. Okay. So, let's talk about encrypting messages. And how do we want to go about doing this? Well, assume that everybody's got a public encryption key. We know that if I want to encrypt, if I've got a, say, a 2048-bit RSA public key, and it's the product of two 10^24-bit primes, that I can encrypt only things up to 2048 bits in size. And in fact, it's a little bit less than that. There's always at least like 11 bytes for padding, so I lose a little bit less. Okay? You know, I lose some space. Now, I could encrypt a message by encrypting it in bits and pieces, but we know that that's inefficient, and so the common technique is to generate a random session key, and I use the word session here, a bulk encryption key, a symmetric encryption key, when I want to encrypt an email message, and I'm going to encrypt the bulk of that message with that encryption key, and then I'm going to take the random the random bulk encryption key and encrypt that to the recipient's public key. So I'm always going to basically do two levels of encryption. I'm doing this double wrapping. It's generate a random key for running something like AES over the contents of my message, however big the message is, and then take that key and encrypt it to the other person's RSA key or something else like that. I have a question.
Is that the same as, I've heard that called data enveloping, is that right? You ever heard it called that?
I believe that term comes from one of them, that may be from one of the modes inside of S-Line, where they talk about enveloped data versus encrypted data versus signed data. Okay. And that has to do with just some of the internal formats inside of the structure that the S-Line stuff moves in. That's the basic idea, okay? Right? So, you gotta have a good source of random numbers, right? We always have a good source of random numbers because we're cryptographers, and that's just one of the tools we have. And, you know, you pick a key out of the air randomly, you encrypt with it, and you send that key across. And so that's what you're gonna do, okay?
One more quick question.
Sure.
I've heard that there are a lot of motherboards, new ones coming out, or have this, an AES chip of some kind built right onto them?
Not quite. Yes and no. They have something called a TPM, called the Trusted Platform Module. Version 1.2, actually. There's some 1.1, 1.2. That's a chip that's basically got an RSA key on it, and it can do RSA, encrypt, and decrypt. Some variants of that chip have an AES engine on it. It has a hardware random number generator that can do like 75 kilobits, I think, for random numbers. So, and those already exist. I mean, you've been able to buy laptops from IBM for a while with an earlier version of that chip. And like all the new Mac, the Intel Macs have those chips and a lot of the other ones. So hardware random number support isn't actually that new. Intel actually had a chipset about 5 years ago, I think, that had a hardware random number generator on the Southbridge, which is the chip that actually connects things like the serial ports and the parallel ports and that sort of thing into the main CPU bus. Never really caught on. You know, you need extra drivers to take advantage of and that sort of thing. With the TPMs, if you've got a hardware source of randomness, you would want to use that to mix into your random number generator that you've got. Now, you can talk about a hardware chip being able to do AES, okay, and that could be fast at doing AES. These chips aren't fast, okay, but they could be. They're basically 8-bit processors, okay. The goal of these things is that it's like putting a smart card onto the motherboard. It gives you a good source of random numbers and a piece of hardware that protects the key, okay. And if you want to know more about that, that's probably a really good topic for doing one of the projects, assuming we do projects, which we'll talk about at the end. Okay, but there are other cases where you've got AES network cards, for example, that are doing AES for IPsec. Very commonly have an AES core on them. If AES cores are cheap, it's like 20,000 transistors or something, it's easy to kind of speed up. Okay, so what we're going to do for encrypting is, use symmetric encryption. Randomly generated keys for the body of the message, And, you know, we're going to obviously use that in some mode as to how we actually apply the symmetric encryption to the body of the message. And then do public key encryption on that and send both pieces across. And here's the pretty picture, okay? You know, Alice writes her little message here, picks this random symmetric key out of thin air, encrypts the bulk of the message with the random symmetric key, then encrypts that key and puts it, as the picture shows, don't you love these pictures, from the vault that then gets encrypted. This is Bob's public key. And then sends both of those across. So one S-line message basically has two parts. It's got content encrypted with a symmetric key, and it's got the symmetric key encrypted with the public key of the recipient. Make sense so far? Real straightforward, right? Okay. So talk about decrypting. When you want to do message decryption, you just reverse it, right? There's no special tricks here. You're a recipient. You go find the block that's encrypted to you with your public key. You apply your private key to decrypt it. You get a session, the symmetric key out. You then bulk decrypt, and away you go. Okay? And that's exactly what you do there. There's no sort of complexity to that. Okay? That's all there is to it. At the public key encryption side, assuming you've gotten your keys around. Now, if you're signing, well, how do we want to sign? Okay, and the key thing here is we're going to end up signing hashes of messages. We don't sign messages directly for a couple reasons. One, first off, I can't sign anything that's very big. I'm limited to the size of the modulus. And if I took a message that was a kilobyte and I signed every, say, 128 bytes or 256 bytes, depending on the size of my signing key, well, I could mix and match those pieces and people could rearrange them. There's just sort of no ordering between them. I'd have to do a lot of work linking, and it would be very expensive because signing is slow, right? Especially if I'm in the world where I've got E is 2 to the 16 plus 1, and, you know, I'm doing public key encryption, but doing the decrypt or the signature generation is slow. I wouldn't want to do that. I don't want to do that very often. So we use the collision properties of a hash to say whatever message you want to sign, generate a hash value on it, sign that hash, and that's how you do a signature, okay? And that's, in fact, what I just told you, right? So the important thing is choosing this hash function, and the hash function has to get communicated as part of the message. You have to sort of say what hash function you're using, because the guy at the other end has to use the same hash function. Question here in front.
Are we hashing the clear text message, or are we hashing the entire encrypted WAD with the clear text and the session key?
Okay, so that depends upon whether we're just signing or signing and encrypting. And there's actually been a debate over that inside the cryptographic community as to whether sign and encrypt is better, or encrypt and sign, or sign encryption, which tries to do the two things kind of simultaneously. In the S-MIME case, it's sign and then encrypt. So you are signing the clear text, and then you are putting an encryption wrapper over the top of it. Okay, that's the default, I believe, in S-MIME. Now, there are modes where you could set it up, and you could programmatically do it the other way. You could generate the encryption first and then sign it. We tend to frown on that because we don't like signing things we can't necessarily see. I mean, if I gave you in most cases, if I gave you an envelope and I said, please go sign this thing, and I'm not telling you what it is, would you do that? Chances are you probably wouldn't, right? And so, you know, that's sort of the typical scenario. Now, there are cases where we actually want blind signatures, okay, but not in this case. In this case, what tends to happen is it's encryption over the outer, is the outer wrapper, and then we decrypt. And then inside we check a signature.
So that means only the person who receives and has the private key that can decrypt that message can verify that it's been signed.
That's right. Now there are, that's right, in sort of the standard case, right? If you get an encrypted message, all you know is whether it's to you or not. Okay. There are cases where you want some different property, and you could choose to put the signature outside. The thing is, if you put the signature outside, you could even detach the signature. And you could sign the clear text, the plain text, stick it outside and then encrypt and send the two along. That's kind of useless because you might also be disclosing some information.
Yeah.
Right?
Nobody could verify it, right? They couldn't verify it.
They couldn't verify it until they decrypted it, and why give them the signed hash to play with? Okay? So generally, sign then encrypt. Okay. But again, there's been some debate upon this in the community. But that's kind of the way S/MIME works. Okay. Choose a hash function. Now notice that our security really depends upon the security of the hash function here. If we're just talking about signing and the hash function can be broken, I can do a cut and paste attack where I can take your signature off one message and paste it to something else if I can control what the hash value of something is. Okay. So that's why we actually really care about the collision resistance properties of hash functions. Because if you say, I owe Brian $10 and I can cut that signature off and paste it onto an I owe Brian $100,000 statement, you're probably not going to like that. Okay. But the key thing with generating digital signatures is just we're going to take the contents of the message, and it can be as long as we want. We're going to hash it. We're going to get a short value out. That hash value has obviously got to be smaller than the size of the modulus of whatever we're using to sign. And we generate, you know, this signed hash, and we just concatenate it onto the message at the signature level. If I'm going to do encryption, I'll add the encryption on top. Now, when I verify, I actually have to independently compute that hash function. So what a recipient does when they get the message in and they're just trying to verify a signature is they're going to take the contents that was hashed and they're going to hash it themselves and they're going to compare the hash value they gave you to the hash value that was signed by the sender and make sure they're identical. Okay? And that's how you verify. You can't sort of completely go backwards. You can't, you know, you basically, what you do is you run the same hash computation and see if the hash that was sent with the message, when you apply the public key, the verification key to it, get the hash value, when that matches the hash value that you computed yourself. Okay? So when you do signature verification, you're actually, you know, you're recomputing. And so that's why, you know, there's this, if you're trying to do this streaming very fast, you want to know up front what hash function you have to use so you can start hashing all the content and then compare it at the end of the day to what you've got at the end of the message. So there's a lot in the way these things were structured. And you'll see that sort of all the public key stuff happens at the end after you get the content so that you can do the processing on the content first and then compare it in case you're processing like megabyte messages and you have to do it in streaming mode. And you'll see, yes, question?
What does the blue key symbolize here?
That is the public key of the signer.
Why would the signer transmit the public key?
Well, so again, this comes back to a key distribution question. Okay, in S/MIME, and I'm gonna talk. You know, this sort of is a precursor to what we'll talk about the next time I give a lecture. The S/MIME format contains a slot for the signer to send along certificates to help prove to the recipient that he is who he says he is. Okay? Now, if we're in a case where we all have access to some directory or something and we know each other's public keys, then I don't need to send that. I can just go pull it out of the directory. But if I'm on the internet in general and we've never met before, I'm going to want to send you some information along with the message to convince you that my signature key really does belong to me. Okay, and that's what that is.
And that's signed by a CA too.
Usually. And that's signed by a CA and chains up just like we talked about in the SSL case.
Question. Does this also apply for archiving the messages as well, that their key might change over time?
Certainly the signature key might change over time, that's correct, and you might want to archive that. I actually think I'm going to give you a problem on the problem set about timestamping, which is sort of how do I know that the signature was valid at the time it came from, and what are some techniques for that. And that will go up late tonight or tomorrow morning when I finish writing that up. But it is useful if people change their signing keys frequently or they change it, you know, every so often. It is a way to archive that. But just like in the SSL case where when I connect to Amazon, I'm getting Amazon's key and I want some information to help convince me it's Amazon's key, if you get a mail message from me, how do you know that I'm actually ballot@microsoft.com, right? Maybe some search come along and maybe that convinces you.
Key management question. If you renew a certificate because it's expired,
yep.
Should you always renew the public key, or are there scenarios where it's valid to...
There are scenarios where it's valid to roll it over. Okay, so the answer is it depends. Okay, I can give you nothing greater than that. If it's a perfect world And yeah, it, you can generate. Look, key generation is cheap, and there's no reason because there's no value inside that thing. And yeah, you can go ahead and roll it over. There are certain CAs that basically require you to roll it over. Okay, but let's say that you're not an endpoint, but you're an intermediate, and you've signed other things, and you don't want those signatures to break. Then you need to keep the same key. And we'll talk about this when we talk about certain hierarchies. But both scenarios are valid. Okay. What tends to control in this case is more risk policy. Okay. And so when you think about what's the risk, sort of what, how much is the key signed? How much has it been used? How long has it been out there? You know, is it time for it to go over? Or has there been some quantum improvement in factoring that all of a sudden makes that algorithm no good anymore, something like that that causes you to change?
When you say roll it over, you mean change the key?
Yeah, so there's this concept of key rollover and key renewal. So let's say that I've got a key, and it's my signing key, and you're a CA and you've signed it, okay? And I buy your CA services, so the cert you give me for that's good for only a year. Now a year goes by, and I go back to you, and I get a new cert. Is it a new cert on my same signing key, or do I change my signing key? And some of that depends upon whether my key is in hardware versus software, and how easy is it to change, and how much value is associated with it, and is there reputation capital? For example, let's say it's that key on the motherboard, right? Well, I may renew certs on that every so often, but I'm not going to pry the chip off the motherboard and replace it. If I'm in a pseudonym situation or an anonymous situation where my reputation is my key, imagine that eBay did some security and all our messages were signed and people knew me by the key I used to sign bids in eBay. I wouldn't want to give that key up because there was reputation associated with it. So it really kind of comes down to that those sorts of questions as much as anything else. Question over here.
Does that mean the hash value does include the certificate in the series of
hashes? No, that certificate, and you'll see this in a bit when I get to texture. The certificates that you send along with an S-MIME messenger outside the signature area.
So if you do key rollover, you could actually theoretically exchange one certificate.
You could pull the certs out and put other ones in, unless you take steps to explicitly include them. In the standard way S-MIME's done, the bag of certificates is just a slot at the end of the message where you can toss as much cruft as you want. Okay. Now, these are very simple signatures, but there's a lot of scenarios where we actually have more complex signatures in the world. Places where we want to have a single signer acknowledging something that has legal effect, or multiple signers collaborating and signing the same document in parallel, or, you know, co-signatures, or counter-signatures, where I sign something and then my boss counter-signs to say he agrees with what I've done. And the format has to support that too. So while I've talked at the moment about just having sort of one signature, we also have to support both signatures in parallel and signatures in series. Okay? In parallel, imagine two people who both want to attest to the same statement and you want to carry those two signatures around in the same message, but they're not one signing the other. It's just Alice and Bob both signing the same hash value. So you have some message that maybe they've collaborated on that's here. You generate a hash value, Alice signs it, Bob signs it, and there's a way to include both of those in the message, in parallel. Okay? Alice isn't attesting to Bob, Bob isn't attesting to Alice, the two of them are just basically saying, yeah, we signed this doc. Okay? Counter signatures are more interesting. This is a situation where someone signs something and the second party wants to sign the fact that the first party signed the doc. Okay? And there, you're just going to apply the same operation in series, one after the other. Alice gets a message, pumps it through the hash function, gets a hash value, signs it, constructs a message. Bob countersigns, basically takes a hash that includes Alice's signature, gets that hash value, signs it, and he attaches his information to it. And so you get sort of, and you can cascade these things too. You could imagine having a countersignature that had a countersignature. If you wanted to sort of represent some sort of a workflow where you had three people signing things. Now, the actual structure looks like this, okay? Inside, so this originally started as something called PKCS7, which stood for Public Key Cryptography Standard Number 7. Really a sort of a unique and very descriptive name, which has now been replaced by the nomenclature certificate cryptographic message syntax of CMS. So this is the RSA name, and this is the IETF name. And if you look in the ITF, you'll see the thing called CMS under SMIME. CMS version 3 is what we're on now. So within a message, we have a version number. Okay, you always have a version number because things are going to change over time. The identifier of the digest algorithm, that's the hash algorithm. Okay, that's the digest is hash. Okay, so this is the thing that says I'm using SHA-1 or I'm using SHA-256 or what have you. Content, which is much larger relative to the rest of these pieces than is implied by the diagram. A slot for some certificates, if I want to include them. A slot where I can include revocation information. CRILs are a certificate revocation list, which again we'll talk about later in the PKI lecture. But these two slots are basically information about how the signer is going to try and convince the recipient that he is who he says he is. And they're unsigned. And then we have this section called signer infos, which is one or more blocks of signatures. And so here's a signer info blown up. And again, another version number, a serial number for the signature, which I forget why that's there. That may be a link into the certificates, if I remember correctly. The digest algorithm for the hash this guy used. There's then two buckets of attributes. Again, in the grand scheme of sort of extensible protocols, one of the things that was seen as valuable was that at the time at which you're signing the content of a message, you might want to stick some metadata in. Like you might want to attest to the time at which you signed something. Or you might want to say that, you know, you not only saw this content, but you agreed wholeheartedly with it. Or you might want to say, I really disagree with this thing, but I'm required to sign it because I have to acknowledge that, you know, something. Those are authenticated attributes. This is a place where you can put arbitrary information that is covered under the signature you're generating. Now, if you're going to have authenticated attributes, you could also have unauthenticated attributes. That's a bucket of bits that isn't signed. Counter-signatures go in the unauthenticated place, because when you construct the signature, you basically got this slot that isn't covered by anything, isn't covered by a hash, and can grow, and that's where a counter-signature goes, if you want to put a counter-signature in. And then the signer's digital signature goes at the end of the day, and that's the structure. And you can have multiples of these.
I thought a counter-signature signed all of it.
The counter-signature signs
all of it.
All of it countersigns basically this thing, and there can be multiple countersignatures. And this thing, so what happens is there's a cascade going on here, okay? You've got a hash of this content that is identified by this guy. This structure here, or at least this piece here, gets hashed and signed by this guy. It stores here. If I have a counter signature, what he's going to hash and sign is this stuff, is the signature.
So if I have multiple signers in parallel at the end of this thing,
yep,
then the counter signature is to a particular one of those, not to the.
That's center. Right, not to the group of them. Okay, if you wanted to have a counter signature that was over three signers in parallel, then you'd need a different counter signature structure. You could do such a thing.
Wrap it, the whole thing, in another message, right?
You could wrap it, or you could put something into the way in which you formatted the counter signature to explicitly reference those things. But it is valid to take these things apart at the signer info level and sort of reshuffle them. There isn't an ordering implied here, right? You can do that sort of thing. So if you're gonna, you can do something like that, but the standard that to the extent that it's specified, attaches a counter signature to a particular signature, not to a pair of them. Now, when we get to XML a little bit later, it's actually possible to do exactly what you said and sort of intertwine the counter signatures, because it allows you to do more complicated references. And I'll show you how that works. Or we can do it off the side.
And again, this is all signing, not encrypting.
This is all signing. If you're going to encrypt, you're going to put the layer on top. It just wraps. Okay. As part of SMIME. Oh, I'm sorry.
How would you get the information in order to, verify the counter signature?
How would I verify the counter signature?
So, you have the signer info, gives you information about who signed and...
Yeah. Oh, the counter signature basically has a similar structure inside it. So the counter signature is another one of these signer infos. It's like nested. Okay. It uses the same structure for that sort of information, yeah. Question?
So, one of the digest algorithm things is redundant, right?
The same, right? I think I got this one. I think this is actually the signature algorithm. So here's the difference. You're right that the way I've got it written, one of them is redundant, but you're actually talking about two different things, okay? So at this point, you're talking about how you'd hash this content in such a way that everybody sort of looks at the same hash value. You still got to specify how this guy here generated his signature, because you might be mixing an RSA signature with a DSA signature. So there has to be a signature algorithm identifier somewhere, okay? And due to what you may actually be doing, because you always sort of sign hashes, it may actually be that what this is like RSA with SHA-1, and you're actually hashing over the hash of the other guy, okay?
And then what are the revocation lists for?
Hold that thought till my next lecture, okay? I'll give you the 30-second view. The certificate is a binding between your key and a name, and it's this thing the CA attests to. When that binding goes bad, the CA has got to somehow tell you it's bad. A CRIL, a certificate revocation list, is one way of the CA saying, I no longer believe the binding.
Somebody has a cell phone over there that's turned on, I think. Somebody at Red West everyone make sure you have your cells off.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm sorry. Ask
a question. Isn't the CRL info in a certificate too?
No. A certificate's got a pointer to a place you can get revocation information. It doesn't actually contain anything in and of itself. And when we get to certs, I'll show you how that works. Okay. And we've actually learned the industry's moved away from that model for revocation, but because at the time this was done, that was the way it does. You have that option. I don't know anybody who actually puts CRILs in, because the CRILs tend to be much bigger. But generally, that process of finding revocation information is left to the recipient until the recipient cares about it. Right? There's a lot of people who don't care.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense to send the list that has your certificate in it, right, saying, my certificate has been revoked.
No, but you might want to send a list as proof that your cert's not on it. Okay? And you can imagine other types of revocation statements. You can imagine a freshness statement that says, you know, here's my cert that I got from the CA that's good for a year, and I went back with him and I just got a statement from him that proved that my cert was still good as of 5 minutes ago to help convince you. Okay? There's lots of ways to trade that workaround. Any other questions before I move on? Let's talk about limitations. Two big limitations, which we'll see are going to lead into the XML stuff. This TKCS7 or CMS standard only covers what's called a wrapped signature. That is where the structure contains the content that's signed. So if I am signing a JPEG, for example, the JPEG data is wrapped inside this SMIME structure and now becomes an SMIME structure. And I have to strip the signature off in order to get the JPEG back. Which means I have no natural way of sort of associating a signature with the data if I want the data back in its original form. Okay, so one of the problems with this format is, let's say that I'm sending, signed DLLs or CAB files around. Okay, the way the standard says to do that is you take the DLL and stick it in the signed object, but I can't use it in that format. I have to undo it because it's completely encoded. In fact, by the time at which the data hits here, this isn't even straight binary. This content here gets ASN.1 encoded, which basically changes into a different binary packing format. And so it's basically illegible, except to the SMIME decoder. Now, how do you get around that? Well, people come up with ways of embedding these things inside of stuff like DLLs and things like that. But the natural support from SMIME is always wrapping. It's wrapping signatures, wrapping encryption around. I mean, the encryption obviously is wrapped, but the signature wraps around the data that's to be signed. It also assumes that you're starting with a byte stream that's completely immutable. Now, that seems like what you'd normally want, right? You want to detect any changes in the signed content. However, more recently, there are places where you actually don't want to do that. Imagine if I'm clear signing text, okay? That is, let's say that I'm sending a text message, and I want the message to be legible to people who don't have signature decoding software. So I'm going to send a straight text, and I'm going to attach the signature at the end of it. Well, mail transport may rewrite parts of that message in ways that are seamless to humans, right? It may change tabs to white space. It might you know, wrap columns. I mean, wrap columns is sort of a, you know, change a bunch of things that might change character and line feed, the line feeds, things like that, that we would consider to be sort of semantically neutral, but breaks a pure hash. Right? Normally, you think you want to detect any change in it. There are cases where you might want to let a little bit of flexibility in, and S-MIME doesn't let you do that. Big case where that happens is in XML. So we'll kind of, I'll tell you what, why don't we break, I'm going to break early here since we're going to save some time because this is sort of natural to go into the XML point. So why don't we come back at 8:25 and we'll start in on XML, and I'll run until 10 after 9, and then we'll stop there and start talking about final projects, I think, 9 to 9:15. We'll see how far we get. Okay, so 5 minutes. Redmond ready? All right, I probably have too many slides for the time remaining, so we'll skip. I always buffer at the end of my talks in case I run out of material, which doesn't seem to happen, but we'll get you through the important stuff. So I've talked about S-MIME, and that is, again, the common case, and I want to switch gears and I want to talk about XML. Yeah. And sort of what we learned from the S-MIME case to give you a greater flavor for how we do signing in a slightly different environment where some of the limiting and simplifying assumptions of S-MIME don't exist, and also because I spent many years of my life doing this, and so you should suffer through it for a little bit too. Okay. Does everybody know what XML is? Right? XML is stuff that looks like this. It's this, you know. It's very aerodynamic because it's got all these little less than signs that make the data travel fast down the wire. You know, this is XML, data structures, right? Textual representation of data structures. Become very hot recently. It is this W3C standard, extensible markup language, came out of the same thing that gave us HTML, was this structured graphics markup language, but really the way to think about XML these days is a textual representation for data structures. I got this great definition earlier this morning out of Wikipedia. Love Wikipedia, great resource. XML provides a text-based means to describe and apply a tree-based structured information. Right? It's a way of taking structured data and representing it as text. Great. You think wonderful. Basis of web services, new basis for the way we're going to send information around on the web, lots of uses for structured data, provides nice interop. Guess what? We want to sign and encrypt XML, because we want to secure it. We want to basically take these nice XML objects and protect them. Well, how should we do that? Answer number one, stick it in an S-MIME object. We got S-MIME. S-MIME supported. Everybody has S-MIME support. Everyone knows how to do it. We can take the XML object. We can stick it in the S-MIME object. And now we get a signed and encrypted XML object. It's just a sequence of characters. It's Unicode characters. So, you know, it's double byte before I, you know, do the appropriate UTF-8 encoding on it. I just hash it, right? Well, there's a little problem with that. The XML people like things to be in XML. And if you take an XML object and you stick it in S-MIME, what you get out is not XML. You get a binary blob that's completely opaque. One of the benefits of XML is that you can look at this thing and understand its structure. And in fact, even if you don't understand the way some substructure should be, because you don't have sort of a priori knowledge of like the data structure of an address field or like a city-state zip, there's ways in which you can download schemas over the web to kind of teach yourself what the structures are that you should be looking at if you're looking at a very complex data structure. So you say to somebody who's, I'll say, an XML zealot, and I mean that in the nicest way, that you ought to take the XML structure and just binary encode it, stick it inside of an S-MIME object, get some ASM.1 out, you get a binary blob, which you then want to ship around as XML, so you have to base64 encode that to ship that around. They don't like that very much because it kind of breaks the entire religion of XML. Okay? So what you want is a way to sign and encrypt an XML object and end up with something that is XML and plays in the XML world. Okay? Which means it's time to go back and take all the things that we learned from S-MIME and apply them into this different textual space where the rules are slightly different and where you want to make sure that you kind of have not made some of the mistakes in the past and where you have fewer assumptions. So,
isn't it also true if you're going to encrypt this, you don't want them to be able to decipher any meaningful information from looking at this new XML thing that you created.
Depending, and we'll actually see that when we get to the my encryption slides in a little bit. When you encrypt XML, you have more choices about what you encrypt. You might want to encrypt all this. You might and say it's just opaque. You might want to say it's a payment instruction, but I'm going to encrypt everything inside. Or I might say I'm going to encrypt the credit card number, but I'm going to tell you it's a credit card number, and I'll tell you about all the other stuff, right? Depending on who's got to process what. You could imagine making an XML payment to Amazon where I encrypt the credit card number and they send that on to the bank, and the bank gets the decrypted value there, but everything else they kind of do. Or you can imagine a scenario where I actually give Amazon an encrypted credit card payment information and an encrypted address, and they don't know where the object's being sent to, and they don't know who's paying for it. They just know the payment's good because the bank said yes, and UPS said yes, we can deliver to this address, but we won't tell you what it is.
Wow.
And you get anonymous purchases, right, which would be a great thing and doesn't seem to be happening anytime in the near future. But you can play games like that, you know? I mean, you could imagine certain businesses that would really like that property, right? You know,
some of them aren't too good either, depending. Right?
The businesses?
Well, you could be selling arms that way or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I assume the porn business would take over first because they seem to take over everything first. Yeah. But after that, you're right. You could be selling arms, you know. We can't let alcohol go to, you know, anyone under 21 or in certain states, you know, all these sorts of things. So one thing is, you know, you want it to be XML. The other thing is, and this, again, is a religious point. XML looks like that, but it's not that. The XML people will tell you again and again and again, as often as they think it's necessary for you to understand, that is simply a textual representation of an object in the XML infoset model. Okay, and that XML, that you have to think about XML as information living in an object space, and we serialize it in various ways, and this is the common way we serialize it. Now, the reason that that's important, if I jump back to my other slide, is that this is a big point that you just don't get in the SMI space. There are many equivalent representations of XML, and they want the property to be that if you sign two equivalent representations, the hash values are the same, therefore the signatures are the same, even if the textual representation is slightly different. So, for example, where there is places where there is insignificant white space, it should not change the thing you hash. If it turns out that there are a couple of different tags that mean the same thing, it should not change what you hash. This was a completely different problem from the way in which we think about NestMime, which is it's a byte sequence, let me hash it and I'm done. You can't kind of get there. So there are these transforms that get applied. There are things that you can do, and they expect that when XML moves hop to hop around the web, people are going to shred it and rip it apart and reassemble it and put it back together in a way in which the exact sequence of characters may be different, but the semantics are the same. Okay? Well, that presents a different problem to us because the way we think about hashing is we think about byte sequences. And if we're going to say that we have to have two different things that have to generate the same hash, they generate the same signature, then there better be an intermediate step there where we canonicalize them. And that's what you end up doing. And I'll show you how that works. Okay, so XML was catching on. In July 1999, there was an effort within the W3C to standardize on how to sign XML, called XML DSIG. It was actually formed as a joint working group between the IETF and the Web Consortium because both claimed to want it done, and they said, oh, we'll work together. As a result of that effort, the IETF and the W3C will never work together again. It did not work out so well. Just two different cultures and two different processes. This was actually the second time the Web Consortium tried to sign web pages. Before I joined Microsoft, and the way I got kind of recruited to Microsoft in 96-97, was their first attempt where they were trying to use S expressions that were in these things called PIX labels that were primarily designed for rating web pages for nudity and violence and sex and bad language and things. And they were trying to use those to sign web pages, and it kind of didn't go anywhere. And this was the second attempt, and it's been a lot more successful. And I can tell you all about that some other time. But this started in 99, and so then a year later, we started an XML encryption effort to encrypt XML for the obvious reason that you want to encrypt stuff too. And we'll talk through now basically what happens with digital signatures. So this nice joint standard, you've got a doc, there's a W3C recommendation, it's got an IETF RFC number on it, And the key thing is it's a way to create signatures of things as XML objects. The things you sign can be XML. They can also be binary. They can be detached binary. So you can take like an MPEG video stream and create a signature to it. That's an XML object and ship that around separately. Signatures don't have to move with the content. You can sign portions of documents. You can say, here's a big long XML thing, but I only want to sign paragraph 15. And there's a way to actually do that. There's a way to actually embed signatures inside of documents. So all the sorts of things that we can't do with SMIME easily, we learned from and took when we did sort of the desig thing. There's problems with it too, but you know, we kind of learn. And then this is what gets used in all this web services stuff. So when you get to WS security and we think about doing web services over the internet, the way we secure those, we sign things with XML desig. So we had a bunch of requirements that are different or more, or stricter than what happened in the SMIME space. The first is this notion of we couldn't just wrap a signature around an object anymore. Now, even if you're in the XML space, you can say, well, the way in which you're going to XML sign something is you're going to take the thing you want to sign, and you're going to wrap this signature goop around it, and you're going to put the little angle brackets on it, and you're going to make it XML, and you're going to get an XML object. And that's fine. That's called a wrapped signature. But we also had a requirement that you had to be able to detach and send a signature separate from the thing that was signed. And then you had to also be embedded. And embedding was the ability to take the signature and embed the signature deep down into the object that was signed somewhere. I'll give you the common example. I write a document in Word, okay? And I want to sign the doc. And I want to embed the signature into the doc so that the doc carries the signature along with it. But I don't want to wrap it. I don't want to put the signature around it because that changes the meaning of the outer structure. I want someone who isn't aware that the signature's there to look at the thing and say, oh yeah, it's a Word document, an XML Word document, say, but that if I know that I'm looking for the signature, I can find where it is embedded. So I'm actually going to embed something into a surrounding signed content. Now, warning bells should be going off in your heads because you know that what you sign is this thing you hash, and how do I hash something when there's a hole in it that I got to go plug the signature into? Well, that's a design constraint. It's something we had to design for, and I'll show you how that works. Okay. But that's one of the interesting properties of XML desig is that it has a way to do that. It also had to do this multiple representations thing. So we had to define this notion of canonicalization, where you take multiple textual representations of the same abstract XML infoset object and make sure they hash the same way. So the crypto works out the same way. Okay? Mostly because you're going to sign an object in one place and it's going to move through the world, and when it comes back out, it's going to drop a space character somewhere. Or someone's going to rewrite character turn line feed to line feed. Or they're going to rewrite, ampersand less thans as ampersand LT semi or something like that. You know, they're going to basically, do some sort of semantically neutral rewrite somewhere. And it has to also support signatures over collections of objects. So in SMIME, you had one content you were signing. In XML desig, let's say that I've got 5 objects that I want to sign with one signature operation. I want to be able to do that too. And now you think, okay, well, that's just 5 hash values I want to sign. Well, got to support that. So wrapped signatures is just like SMIME in CMS. I have some signed content. I have a signer info. And I point to the thing that's inside that I'm signing. Very straightforward, okay? Only useful if you're really signing small amounts of data, okay? If I'm signing a video stream or something, not going to use it. Not going to wrap something this way. But if I'm signing little web services messages or something like that, I might do something this way. But again, the thing at the top level looks like it's a desig signature, and so I have to know that I'm receiving a signature on the other end.
Sorry, why is it only for a small...
You could put as much data as you wanted into it, but the fact of the matter is if you're moving large amounts of binary data around, it's probably more efficient for you to move the binary data directly as binary data and do a detached signature. Okay, I'll show you that in a second. Any binary data that is inside here has to be Base64 encoded. Have you all seen Base64 encoding? So it blows everything up by a factor of a third. Because you can't, there's no binary transfer in XML. You have to have textual representation. So every time I have to put a binary object somewhere, I'm going to take a, I'm going to expand it.
Isn't that email does that too, right?
Email does that in some cases. Yeah, it will, for attachments, it will base 64 encode. You actually there's a bunch of things it could do, but that's the most common one. So if you when you send around like a JPEG along with an email, it gets base 64 encoded. Or, you know, if you send to like an audio attachment or something like that. Yeah. And you get a blow up. You get an encoding blow up when you go to there. Because you're trying to make sure that it's 8-bit clean. 7-bit clean. A detached signature is the thing that we didn't really have formally in SMIME, which is I'm going to create an XML signature object that's going to point to something else on the web that's of some data type. And I'm going to tell you that I'm signing the hash value of this other object. So imagine that, like, CNN puts a video up somewhere, and I want to sign it and say, I think this is an A1 video. CNN doesn't care if I think it's an A1 video, but you do. And so I'm going to sign a statement saying, I think this thing is a grade A1 video, and here's the hash value. And you can verify that, because you can go pull the data down and hash it, and you get the signature there. And so there's a formal way of sort of specifying that. And then there's this neat one, which is embedded, which is I'm going to have, you know, some XML map data that starts off, you know, map, and of course it ends somewhere with slash map, and deep in the middle of it, I'm going to embed a signature that's going to sign the thing that's containing it in such a way that it doesn't get hacked. That's real common, because you now have all these messages going around, and what's really happened is, you know, somebody designs a big, complicated XML structure, and then after the fact, they realize they want some security with it. Because that's how it always happens, right? You know, people decide they want some signature later. Yeah. And so, after you design the object, you say, oh, well, we'll just stick the signature down here in the bottom. And that way, version 1 clients that don't know about it, you know, will skip over it and see it, that sort of thing. And so this gets used a lot, too. But it means that you have to have a way of identifying content minus the where the signature goes, because you can't hash the thing that you're trying to. And there's a recursion problem here. If you right, you guys kind of get that, right? You can't. You have to calculate the hash of the thing minus what it is that you're going to be. Another big thing for XML that differs from SMIME was this notion that we had to support signing parts of documents. In the SMIME case, you sign whatever's in the content block. And it's an all or nothing sort of thing. You don't get choice. If you want to sign parts of a doc, you do different SMIME structures. In workflow scenarios, in cases where I'm going to have a big form and I'm going to have different people fill it out and stuff like that, or I'm going to have, you know, person A sign off on the first part of this contract and person B sign off on the second part of this contract, I need to be able to say what it is I'm signing. So there's this notion of transforming something, of identifying input and then passing it through a series of transforms to get the thing that you're actually going to sign and hash. Okay? And these transforms can basically say pick out a piece of it, or take every other sentence, or only sign, you know, capital letters or what have you. Normally it's used for picking out a subportion of a document. Let's say that you've got a really big document, but you only want to sign the data that you have personally verified, something like that. And so that's part of the model, too. Now, workflows become a real big thing. This notion that you've got some form here where Alice and Bob are collaboratively going to fill it out. Alice fills out the first half and Bob fills out the second half. Right? So Alice fills out a part of the form, and then she signs just that part. Pass it on to Bob. Bob fills out his thing and then goes on, and you get two signatures. So you've got a signature over different parts of the doc. And of course, you could interlace these. You could have this be Alice, Bob, Alice Sig, and Bob Sig, if you could even read my handwriting. And you can play all sorts of games like that, because you have the ability to identify portions inside the document of what you're signing. And so this was another big feature that shows up in all of these workflow, web-based forms, document management sorts of situations. Okay. Canonicalization. So now we have this problem that the textual representations of objects aren't necessarily, are going, you have multiple equivalent textual representations. And so we had to create an algorithm that we call C14N. Does anyone know why we call it C14N? What? Yeah, because there's 14 letters between the C and the N. Okay. Similarly, there's something called I18N, which is internationalization. Okay. So if you ever see I18N, internationalization, C14N, canonicalization.
L10N.
What? L10N. L10N, localization. Yeah, there you go. So here was the problem we faced. We have a to-be signed content that actually could show up in multiple representations, and we want to make sure that it has the same signature. If the same signature key signs it, you get the same hash value out. Okay? And so what we needed was this algorithm, or a series of algorithms, that have different properties and are robust in different ways of different types of transformations, that would take the textual representation and convert it into the canonical byte sequence for the object that textual representation represents, so you could then hash it. Okay? So there is an entire separate spec that is at least as large as the XML DSIG spec on how to do this. It may not be quite as large, but it's about the same size. On how to do this for an XML object. And what it comes down to is things like normalizing white space, normalizing carriage return line feeds. These are things that you don't expect cryptographers actually have to deal with on a regular basis, but it actually is something because we had to take an existing environment and engineer a cryptographic solution for it. Okay? And so what you do is you have to do, in XML, there are ways of saying that A colon foo and B colon foo are equivalent. And that A here is a prefix for a namespace, and B is a prefix for a namespace. We went round and around in that for a while. Finally, we gave up and we said, okay, we're not going to figure out how to determine that prefixes are equivalent. So that's why I say that in practice we don't quite get there. There's other sorts of it turns out that the canonicalization is by far the hardest part of this entire problem. It actually had probably more code than the crypto, okay, to actually do the encryption, and it was harder to debug, and it was slower in perf. And so you actually had a case where signing time wasn't as big a deal as what was the canonicalization time.
You're basically just parsing the whole thing.
Not
finding the optimal parse.
Actually, you already have it parsed. You have it as a parsed data structure, and you're going in reverse. Okay, if you've got text coming in,
right.
You basically have to, in the totally formal case, parse it, create a parse tree,
and then
re-spit it back out. Okay? And in fact, you can't even do it in one pass, because you kind of have to walk the tree and change properties all over the place. Okay? Having written this code twice...
Right. So, these namespaces you're talking about,
yeah.
You're saying in some circumstances, even though they have a different foo and foo have a different namespace, they might be semantically equivalent?
So, yeah, it turns out, and I'll give you... If I write A colon foo, and then I can do, you know, law, law, and then I'm still in the same element, XML namespace colon foo equals, and then this is some URL. And that says that A is an alias for this URL over here. It's actually the URL. Oh, yeah. The erase worked. Okay. So now, and imagine this is URL1. And now I do B colon foo, what have you, XML namespace colon B equals
same
URL1. That says A and B are the same. In fact, this doesn't even have to be foo. This can be bar. And it says that A and B now have the same meaning. And if I have A and then B and then down here I do B colon foo, later on within the nested structure, so that, you know, assume these are nested, okay? This B is the same as this B, assuming there hasn't been a separate redefinition meanwhile.
This is the same as A.
And this foo therefore means that. I mean, you know, this whole thing is that whole thing. Okay, so we actually spent a lot of time thinking about whether you rewrite that, and finally we just said, no, we're not going to, you know, if you care about that, rewrite it ahead of time, which is why there are certain semantic variations that aren't. But it's that sort of thing. There are different types of things where we do. I'll give you another example, since we come to practice. So if I say foo, 3, foo, okay, and I say foo, 3 followed by 2 spaces. Are those the same thing or are they different?
If it's a numerical value, they might be the same thing, right?
And is it a numerical value or not?
You don't know.
It's not quoted. It's on the data type.
You don't know because the data type depends upon the schema that tells you what's in between the foo.
Yep.
So foo has a schema associated with it that tells you how to parse what's inside. And this is either significant or insignificant white space depending upon what the structure of the thing is inside. Now, if I write foo r 3, actually these should be slashes. I didn't expect to give an XML lesson tonight, but it's instructive. And there's a space here. That's insignificant by definition. Unless, I mean, that should be insignificant because it's between two tags and there isn't sort of an enclosing character sort of thing. But you get situations like that where these will get rewritten as they fly around the network. And so how I hash these, like if I just take this and this and I pass them to SHA-1, I'm going to get wildly different hash types. I mean, it's not going to be different in just a little places, right? It's going to be things completely different. And so this has to get converted into something that's a C14N format of that so that I can hash it and sign. And if Alice signs that and Bob signs that, that it's the same hash value they're signing. Okay? Question over here.
Is it true that C14N doesn't assume you have access to the schema?
That's correct. And in fact, so this is a little bit of politics. At the time at which XML DSIG was done, schema was not an official standard and part of XML yet. There was this previous thing called DTDs, document type definitions, that they got from the HTML guys that they were getting rid of. And so in a grand decision, they decided that because neither was required yet, we would assume neither existed. And so we can't actually assume that you have schema. In practice, you know, you kind of have to have schema to kind of do these sorts of things. But actually, as far as the official spec goes, that's right, you don't. You can't assume. So the spec was written in such a way that it accommodates it, but it cannot assume such a thing exists. And that causes other problems. I will tell you that when we did this standard, you had two groups of people. You had the XML guys and the cryptographers. And the cryptographers said, just leave the crypto to us and you guys worry about the model. And the XML guy said, we don't want to touch any of that nasty crypto. We'll do the model if you do the crypto. And we didn't get the best thing out of it because of that, because we were very worried about performance of the crypto and minimizing public key operations and thinking about, you know, all those sorts of things. Meanwhile, the canonicalization that was being cooked up had no cares about performance whatsoever. Okay? And so, you know, sometimes even when you're doing cryptography, you've got to really worry about the engineering and the non-crypto parts that are feeding into your system. I have a question over here.
I was actually just going to make an observation. In some of the older web server stacks, I've actually seen canonicalization take more than half the cost of actually signing in a crypto.
I ran a workshop on web services last May and had the CTO of one of these companies that does hardware XML accelerators. Okay, these are guys that sell 1U rack mounted units that you buy for your enterprise that have special purpose hardware in it for doing XML DSIG. Okay, and he said by far what actually took the most time, even more than the canonicalization, was all the XML schema validation and all of the XML parsing. They wrote, they designed special silicon for doing all the XML operations, you know, all that sort of stuff, the XML parsing and operations. For the crypto, they went out and bought a crypto card from somebody else and plugged it in because it was basically, I think, a Linux box that was kind of run on special hardware. But yeah, it takes longer to do the string throbbing more than anything else.
So the canonicalization, are there different implementations produce slightly different results in that? They should.
They
right.
should not. Okay, part of the standard. You're supposed to adhere to it. Okay, that's a bug. What has happened, however, is that people decided they didn't like the first canonicalization algorithm. Okay, so after we came up with C14N, and well, it had a bug. So we came up with this thing called exclusive C14. It wasn't really a bug, but it was just it didn't handle some namespace stuff. So there was this separate thing called exclusive C14N, which pretty much everybody does. And then the folks have looked at all sorts of lightweight canonicalizations because that thing's too heavyweight. And you know, if you really control both ends of the pipe, and you know that you're not changing the XML in one of these weird ways, why pay the cost? And of course, we have the spec allows you to specify what canonicalization algorithm you want. But the standards have to do this default thing. Okay. Anyway, a divergence, but the whole point of this is often the hardest problems in doing the signatures and the encryption are not the signature in the encryption. Okay, they are things about getting the data into the right format so we can apply our standard tools and understanding the scenario so that that happens. And it'll happen to you when you're designing these sorts of things. You will be given problems where you'll assume that you can just hash some byte sequence, and all of a sudden someone will tell you that, well, no, we're actually going to change these things on the way, and we need you to detect these sorts of differences but not these other sorts of differences. And it's just something that you have to account for when you apply the tools, and that generally means you do a pre-processing stage. So in DSIG, we take content, we run it through transforms to select what we want to sign, we get tbsigned content, we canonicalize, we get a byte stream out of that, we hash it, we sign it, and that gives us our signature value, which, by the way, we then base 64 encode, because we can't put a signature value into XML directly because it's binary. And that's how we sign. And we use the same basic tools that we have from the S-MIME world, and it's the same RSA operations or DSA, and it's the same SHA-hash functions. We're just doing it in a textual context. Now, to give you a comparison of a structural overview compared to sort of what you saw in S-MIME, in DSIG, there's this thing called a signature. And inside, it has a signed info. This identifies what it is you're signing. You can think of it as a reference list. And I'll drill into it more on the next slide. It identifies the stuff that's being signed. Signature value, that's the base 64 value of whatever it is you sign. That's the signature block. So if I used an RSA key to sign a SHA-1 hash of this stuff, that's what it is. When I sign in the DC world, I'm signing basically always a hash of this signed info. And it contains hashes of individual objects. So, and I'll show you that in a second. Just like we have that slot for signatures in S-MIME, we have a slot in DSIG for what we call key info, which is whatever stuff you want to throw there that's going to help convey information to the recipient about what key sign thinks. Okay? That could be X509 certs. It could be some Kerberos information, I guess. It could be PGP keys. It could be just raw public key values. It could be strings that say, well, it's Bob's third key on your key ring. It can be anything like that. And then there's a general extension point down here where if you were wanted to embed some stuff to sign, you could put it down there. And that's what an XML DSIG looks like. The key thing in S-MIME, we're always signing the hash of the exact content. In DSIG, what we sign, the thing that the hash value that actually gets input into the SHA-1 hash pump, or into the RSA or DSA, is the hash of this catalog. This is the signed info structure, and it tells you how to canonicalize itself, what signature method you're going to use to sign it, and then these list of references, which are one or more pointers to content to be signed. And that could be pointers to a web page, pointer to a stream, pointer internally to some other section of the document, how to extract sub-portions of it, how to hash that thing, and what the hash value is. So you can have one of these structures where if I want to sign 15 files, I would have 15 references to each of the different files where I include the hash value of each file here, and then I sign the hash of the hashes. Okay, this is a very common technique when you have to sign like catalog files in Windows or manifest or something like that, where instead of signing 15 things individually, you'll create a new object that lists the hashes of those 15 things, and you take a hash of the list of the hashes and sign that. Does that make sense to everyone? So I've seen that. This notion of taking hashes of hashes and just basically signing that so that you save the public key operations. And at the end of the day, what you get is this thing that looks like this. So this is a signature over like my personal home page, which is, here's this URI that says, well, that's a home page. Actually, it just says, go suck that down, hash it with SHA-1. Oh, and another thing that happens in DSIG, all of our algorithm identifiers are URIs, and so they all take up a lot more space. Like, this is the identifier for SHA-1. And here's this Base64 encoding of the SHA-1 hash of the contents of this thing. And then here's the signature value. And that is the...
Is that for just your home page, your index page, or is that more?
No, it's just the index page.
Okay.
So, right, this URI, the whole point is you take the URI and you dereference it and you get a byte stream back. And you hash that byte sequence.
And attach this to the document itself?
You could, or you could ship it around separate. This is a detached signature. This is an independent XML structure. This signature is an RSA SHA-1 signature over that, the hash of that, and that's how I construct it, and I send these little things around. Okay, that's DSIG in a nutshell. Let me quickly go on to encryption, because I promised some time to talk about projects. So in encryption, the situation's a little bit easier because we know what we're going to get out as a byte sequence anyway, that's ciphertext. And what we have to do is say, okay, identify what your plain text is, identify what your algorithm is for encrypting it, encrypt it, base64 encode it, and shove it in an XML object. Okay? Because we know that, well, it's ciphertext. It's not going to have any useful properties. I'm not going to be able to parse it. I'm not going to have any structure in it, at least if that's a good algorithm, right? I mean, if there is structure in my ciphertext, I've made a mistake. Okay? And the basic properties here were that were extensions were things which had to do with making it easier to do this envelope data trick that we do in SMART. To make it easy to say, I'm going to take a random symmetric key, I'm going to use that to bulk encrypt some data, and then I'm going to encrypt that with some RSA keys and pass it around. And so you can, just like you can have wrapped and detached signatures, you can have wrapped and detached encrypted data. You can separate the encrypted data from the metadata that tells you how to do it. A common case where you'd want to do that again would be something like you were going to encrypt a video stream. So imagine you've got a video stream and it's encrypted with some AES key, and I'm going to send you over a separate channel that AES key encrypted your RSA key in an XML format. Okay, and I want to separate those sorts of things out. Satellite encoding, where there's the data that comes down from the satellite that's encrypted, you know, just like DirecTV, that sort of thing. And the keying information sort of happens on a separate channel, or it happens interframe inside the stream that comes down. I'm going to use a separate protocol for sending the keys around than I am for sending the data around. And then there's ways of just embedding encrypted key information around. And that's basically the main of it. Let me just quickly walk you through structure. We distinguish between whether what we're encrypting is content or what we're encrypting is key material, simply so that from a schema perspective we can actually include one inside the other. That's not really important, but there is a distinction when you set the thing up as to whether you're encrypting a key or whether you're encrypting content. And that kind of helps you find, if you're doing this double unwrapping, finding the place where, okay, I'm decrypting the key that I'm going to use to go decrypt the data that's somewhere else. You say how you're encrypting. Sometimes you lie that if it's implied by the protocol. Key info, the encrypted ciphertext, and maybe some properties. That's kind of all there is to the XML encryption. If I show you an example, here's a raw blob that shows, you know, an example, let's say it's a payment instruction, right? It's got a name, a credit card, a number, a bank, an expiration date. Simple little XML blob. Now there's three different ways I'm going to show you that you can encrypt this, which are all have different pluses and minuses. In the first version, what I do is I take the entire credit card element. So I'm going to just encrypt everything. You see where the one is here? I'm going to encrypt all of that. And that entire blob goes away, and you get a payment, a name, and then encrypted blob. And you don't even know what that is. Now, that gives you sort of the most protection over the element, but you actually can't schema validate it.
How did your cipher value get so small?
Oh, because there's an implied dot, dot, dot here. Okay. Yeah, this is actually larger, obviously. Oh, okay. It's just that I just made it small so it fits on the screen.
I was like, that's a cool encryption algorithm.
It's not a reversible encryption algorithm, right? Because I've got very few bytes there. Yeah, so whenever you get large binary blobs, I just kind of made it smaller. Otherwise, it would kind of run off the...
Brian?
Yes, question?
Where did the key info go?
It's dropped in this case. Okay, so let's say that you've actually got a scenario where I've got two ends that have done key exchange through some other mechanism, and it's implied. Okay, and all I'm doing in this case is I know what the key is, and I'm just enciphering. Obviously, you could have that if you were doing it sort of on the fly, but again, for space reasons, it is possible to actually do something this small, because it's sort of implied in a larger channel. And especially if you're talking about XML where you're going to pay a space premium every time you put key information in because you got to do this base 64 encode. If you can align it and drop stuff out, that's an advantage.
Sure.
Okay.
It's just on the other page, it did not say it was optional. On page 7.
I think it is optional. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's optional. Well, if you were going to do an encrypted key, you'd get a separate top-level element that could appear inside. So what you get is, normally what you get is you get an encrypted data, and you can put the encrypted key inside here in key info. But everything inside key info is always optional anyway, so it is sort of by implication. It is certainly the case that you can send an encrypted data across with only implied keys. And I'd have to go to the schema, which I don't have here, to kind of show you that it is. But good point, right? If I wanted to really be self-contained, then, you know, I'd have down here, I'd have a key info, and then I'd have an encrypted key, and maybe I'd have something which was my session key encrypted in an RSA key, or if I had labeled my session key somehow, then maybe instead of this, I'd have something that would say, like, key name, and it would say, you know, encryption key 1. Something like that to identify. Kind of depends on what your protocol is. In the second slide here, what's happened is the number is encrypted. So this is the credit card number element. So I say credit card, and I've got a limit on the currency. But then where I had the number, which was, I'll swap back, this element, so it's all of this, number, issuer, and expiration, all gets encrypted in this example, and just turned in. And again, dot, 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 there's more ciphertext there than I've shown. And then in the third scenario, and again, with a dot, 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 here we actually just encrypt the number itself. And so you can actually schema validate and say, okay, there's a number here. I can't read what it is, but the structure looks good. And then here's the issuer and the expiration, and maybe I send this off to the issuing bank to get it verified or something like that. So you have more choices in how you encrypt things. Just another sort of use of the structure. I have 3 minutes before I promise to switch, and let me see how fast I can give you a taste of web services in 3 minutes. This is going to be fun. How many people here have dealt with web services so far? Many. Okay. Good. So RPC over the internet using an XML protocol and something called SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol. Imagine that now we're going to do things like, we want to do the get quote function on some stock, and we're going to do it as RPC with XML. And I'll say that it's kind of remarkable. I first made these slides about 4 years ago, at which point getting a quote from Microsoft was $27.50. That value still seems to be pretty good today.
At least it hasn't gone down.
Well, there were times when these slides were overly optimistic, let me put it that way. In a web services request response, the request, you have all of this XML goops, you can send the string MSFT to the quote method, and you get back a float, $27.50, that comes back in the response. Okay, now imagine that you want to do signature and encryption over this thing. You want all the same properties that we've talked about all night. You want message level security, you want integrity, you want confidentiality, you want composability, and you don't want to depend upon necessarily any centralized trust model or centralized network topology. And you have XML desig and XML encryption available to you. But you've got to build other stuff on top of that, because that'll give you the raw encryption, but you've got all of the trust model stuff and things like that. So WS Security should think about a framework for doing that sort of thing. I'm going to skip ahead here a bit. The key thing is that it has this notion of security tokens, which is a generalization of something like a certificate. It's the information you're going to send along with the request to prove you have authorization. Could be a username, could be a Kerberos ticket, could be X509, could be something called SAML, could be something called XRML, could be anything else you come up with, completely extensible. And you just want to pass that along, and you're going to pass that along in the slots that were left open for those sorts of things. And you sometimes want to protect parts of messages. And the rest of the slides, to be honest, are just running through examples of how to do that. And so what I'll do is I'll say, if you're interested in looking at those things, go look at the slides. And if you have questions or want to talk about it further, I'm happy to. But I promised at least 15 minutes for us to kind of talk about sort of projects and things like that. So I want to kind of stop here and have that discussion. So let me end on that note. Problem set is not written quite yet. I promise you that there will be at least one or two questions up by tomorrow morning, so that you can have something to get started on while I think of the rest of the questions, because it's kind of hard to come up with kind of good problems that are interesting and sort of done right. But I think there's going to be one on time stamping, which is this notion of how do I sort of convey information about what time it was something was done. And I'll have to explain that a little bit in the problem set. And then the rest will come up hopefully by tomorrow night. Okay. Josh?
Okay, I guess I should jump in here.
You should jump in. We should kind of. You're close to a mic, I guess.
Well, I'll move to the front so that people can see me a little bit better. But I want to stay within camera range up there, so I don't suspect
that. Yeah, that's good. We can see you're right in the corner.
Okay, great.
So, you can take the lead. I've been talking for 3 hours. Go right ahead.
Jump in as you like, but we're pretty much done with 5 weeks, so we're pretty much halfway through, and now we've got to figure out what we're going to do for the end. We took a sense at the beginning, and let's just see if this has changed. So I just want to do a sort of, a straw poll of how many people would prefer a final exam versus a final project. So let's see, how many people would prefer some sort of an exam at the end? So we've got about half in Redmond. What is it?
I have five here. Six, it looks like here.
Okay.
Josh, can you give a brief each of these are involved,
yeah,
actually?
We should tell them what they're voting on before they're voting.
Yeah.
I guess that is fair. Okay.
Is that a secret? I always authenticate the envelope, no problem.
Very good. Go ahead.
A final exam would actually be easier to administer in the sense that I believe it's 1 week after the final week. That evening, we just take the time slot and we give an exam, we grade the exam, we do it with the exam, the final exam / project.
My wig is probably open.
Should be, and you know, John's away. We really should have got through all this beforehand, but it should be in the range of about 30% of the grade, about a third of the grade, something like that.
Yeah.
What will it look like?
What will it look like? So, don't quite know. My preference would be an open book thing, because I don't believe that there's value in closed book exams.
And I agree with that completely.
Okay, I mean, I'm sorry, when it comes to crypto,
it would be like two times the homework, one homework, you know, like as far as size-wise, you know, like.
We've never done it. The last time we did projects, I don't know. Okay. I would guess it. How much time do we have? What do we get? Like 3 hours for it?
Unless you give us take home.
I mean, sometimes.
Unless you give you take.
Sometimes
homework feels like a final exam.
Well, what I'm saying is, 3 hours. I've spent 10 or 15 hours on one of these homeworks, and so if I were asked to do that same kind of work in three, it might be harder.
So. It would certainly be more condensed, smaller.
Yeah.
We're not going to ask you to do enormous problems like this stuff.
Define your terms.
Yeah. Enormous. It's all relative, right?
We can take feedback and get ideas. The way a project would work, which we have a little bit more experience with in this, is since there are so many people in this class, what we would probably do is take the entire final week, the week after the last week, so probably Monday through Thursday, take four nights, and everybody signs up for one of those four nights.
Josh, we'd have to move it a little bit earlier, I think.
Okay.
We would need, well, unless you're going to listen to all of them that week.
Because
I think John and I are on planes, so we should talk this out, okay?
Okay.
So we would take as much time as we can. Maybe it would start the week before, or the end of the week before. So the end of week 10. We take a couple days then. I think we would really need 4 evenings, and everybody get signed up for 1 evening, probably 2 in Redmond, 2 in Seattle, and you come to your evening, you listen to other people's projects, and you present your own. The projects would consist of writing some sort of a report, 5 pages-ish. That's me, forget it. It would be about 5 pages or so of a written report, and then about 10 minutes each of presenting that report.
So no more than like 5 slides, max. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, people who try to do more than 5 slides in 10 minutes, it doesn't work. Okay. So it's that size thing. Okay. I got a question here.
These are individual projects.
These are individual projects.
Individual projects. And what we would do is get people started sooner. So we would ask for something like 2 to 3 weeks from now, people to actually send us, we could do this all by email, project proposals. This is what I plan to do, so that we can comment on something like
that. I got a question here.
Can you define what a typical project scope would be? Like, what are we talking? Is this a program project? Is this
No. These are while they could be in the past, and I actually went and pulled all the topics that folks did last time around. Generally, they're like little sort of you research a little bit of a topic, maybe like a paper on something that we didn't cover. You know, you look at, for example, you give a little presentation. So, for example, MD5 was shown to have collisions a year ago. Maybe you go read the paper and you say, here's what the result was, here's what this showed, here's why it's important, and like, here's what's been done with it or something since. Or maybe somebody investigated WEP, which is the original encryption for 802.11 networks, and you know, their paper was WEP encryption or why it isn't. You know, and that sort of thing kind of described, you know, the attack on that. Or you look at some of the other attacks on crypto systems. There was a good presentation I remember from a few years ago that was historical, that was looking at, like, you know, some of the stuff in World War II and things like that. So they can pretty much range, but, you know, they range, and it's sort of based on interest. What we ask is that you give us a one paragraph sort of abstract / proposal early, so that we can give you the yay or nay and say, yeah, that sounds good or not, or point you kind of in the right direction.
The idea is very, very much one of find something that you think is particularly interesting that you would have liked to have seen a little bit more time spent on, and you get to spend the time. So it's a somewhat more in-depth dive into one area that we've covered or maybe failed to cover, but that is relevant. And we will try to guide you, and if you give us a proposal and we say, well, yes, but that may be too much, why don't you focus in on this, or why don't you also do this because it's important and it's related, or perfect as is, or something like that would be the idea of the proposal. The problem, the biggest issue is that it's now only halfway through the course. We need to get proposals pretty soon, so a lot of the material isn't there yet. So if you're interested in material yet to be covered, again, we can do that, but you have to give us a proposal so that we can work on, well, actually, we will do this much in class, but you know, here's an area that we won't cover. You might want to go down and do something else. That's roughly the sense of what a project is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sounds good.
Cool. So those are kind of, you know, the choices. The only thing I'd add is that while we only would require you to come to the one night that you'd be presenting, if you want to come to other nights, it's always open. If we're in Redmond, we can actually get a larger space, and I think we did that when we did it last time. We actually got a space to accommodate. I don't know what space is like here, but last time we had 2 sessions. They were each, I guess, what, 5.5 hours?
Yeah,
so they went long. I'll just say that 10 minutes turns into longer. Brevity is valued, you know. But no, but you know, and it was, you know, folks kind of liked it. But we can go either way. And you know, it really kind of is up to you at this point. I have a question. Yeah.
This is only distantly related. How many more homework assignments do you anticipate?
Okay, so there will be 8 total.
8 total.
Because there will be no homework on the 9th class because, well, I guess, isn't that right, Josh? I think we planned on 8.
That was our standard, although we could give homework on the 9th class. The issue is... the issue is, we don't have time. You know, if it's given after the 9th class, you turn it in on the 10th, we can talk about it, but we're not going to grade it right away.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Getting it back to you.
If you don't, I have a vote for if we don't have to, let's not.
Of course, 9 is divisible by 3, and I'm doing the 9th class, so I'm going to be the one who winds up doing or not doing the 9th assignment. So, talk to other people. We could do... I don't know. We figured on 8, but...
Okay.
8 is enough, apparently.
I've heard that somewhere before.
Okay. So, why don't we do a little, just, if not a 100% binding vote, but do people understand the 2 options reasonably well at this point?
Yeah.
Okay, so, given this, how many people would prefer some sort of a, you come in once, you get it over with exam? Oh, even more. Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh.
7. So I'm seeing 7 in Redmond.
I've got 4 here.
Okay. And how many would prefer some sort of a final project?
Okay, it's pretty overwhelming here. I'll keep your hands up, we should count, you know.
Now, if it's overwhelming, we certainly we've got about 2.5 times as many people.
What? I have 16 here.
Okay, we had 18 to 7.
In favor of 16 to 4, and obviously some didn't vote. And I don't think anyone voted twice.
Yeah, that's why you're not voting.
So,
in this case,
we use a secure algorithm.
Yeah, we didn't use a secure counting algorithm.
I'll mention quickly, that's one thing that will come up in week 9 a little bit. A lot of people have asked me about, so you know, I'm going to be talking in week 9 about sort of more funky, more abstract, or more unusual uses of public key, and I'm going to spend probably an hour or a little bit more sort of applying some of these interesting public key utilities and features to how to do verifiable elections right. Nobody is actually doing them now. So we talked about that. That could be a project, but again, that's a bit of a problem because that's not fully known. So if you want to do something like that, talk to me, but talk to one of us first. Okay, so we seem to be going down the project route.
Wait, I got a question here.
Yeah, this will definitely come up later, so we might as well bring it up early. It'd be useful to have at least some broad guidelines on how these things will get graded or compared to one another. Or
Yeah, because last time what Josh and I did was we each independently sort of viewed everything and took notes and then kind of weighed them relative and, you know, did sort of a master sort of mesh. So it was...
But if I know you, if you like people with blue eyes, I'll buy the right kind of contacts. It's just, it's good to see your fair notes, but that's still along with the objective criteria.
You should say something to the effect of how much is the written portion and how much is the oral portion. We care about both. We want good, clear presentations, but you know, it's also important to have something good and clear in writing. So.
We will do that, and at the same time, I'll put up the list of what the topics were from last time, so that you can kind of get an idea for the sorts of things folks did. Just so you get a feel.
You give extra points for degree of difficulty.
For interest, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the key thing on these are it should be something you find interesting. Right, because A, you'll be more interested in doing it, and B, you're going to spend some time, you know, you might as well do something that you actually find interesting or related to maybe your job or something like that. You know, we certainly had those last time.
And I'm going to say, since we're going in this, we seem to be going in this direction, I'm certainly partial to this from personal experience. The first crypto course I ever took was as an undergraduate from Ron Rivest. And we did final projects, and the final project I did there as an undergraduate was on a topic that interested me enough and so that even though it was just a small thing there, it later became my doctoral dissertation, years later. So, yeah, I don't know if that'll happen to anybody here, but I want to provide the opportunity to delve into
some. Your doctoral presentation only took 10 minutes?
The first basic, very weak ideas in that direction were...
Yes.
A lot longer. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll work in this direction and we'll come up with something far more concrete for next week to finalize. This is what final projects will be. This is how they'll be done. This is what
All right, thank you all. Have a good evening.
So,
drive safe.